Good morning, everybody. Welcome to our tutorial here. My name is Jie Zhao, and the title of our tutorial is Interactive Lattice-Based Flow Simulation and Visualization. The contents here is what we want to propose is an interactive flow simulation and visualization method based on the Lattice computing. Generally, it is a Lattice Boltzmann method for solving the partial differential equations. For this flow simulation, it is to use to solve the Werfenbach's Navier-Stokes equation. It is a different one from the traditional method as an unique explicit, simple, and parallel scheme. So it is, can be easily accelerated and achieve very fast computing speed with a parallel machine, especially for the on the graphics hardware. And we will also cover the efficient optimization for the general parallel computing for the cluster computing. And then we will introduce that this method can easily handle the boundary conditions, especially for the free surface simulations, as well as some adaptive simulation scheme. We will also cover a variety of applications for the education, security, entertainment. Okay, these are the organizers and presenters. We have a few people. However, Professor Eric Kaufman and Professor Ulrich Reed cannot be here due to some personal issues. So we will cover their topics as well. So here is the basic schedule. After this basic introduction, I will present the theoretic issues for this Lattice-Boltzmann method, as well as on the graphics hardware acceleration. And after that, Klaus Egerberg will introduce the basic method for efficient implementations if you consider to use the cluster for computing, because sometimes using only one computer is not enough. And then we will take the break, and then after break, Professor Klaus Müller will introduce a few applications based on this method. And finally, Niels Thury will give us the very interesting topic on free surface simulation and adaptive simulations. Okay, one more word is that we try to make all of our materials available online, and please go to this link, and we have the slides there. And we will also update that web page when we finish this. And thank you. Okay, so I will begin to talk about the Lattice-Boltzmann method. I'm Ye Zhao from the Kent State University. It's in Cleveland. It's very close to Columbus. Okay, so this Lattice-Boltzmann method is different from the traditional macroscopic method and what we generally use, the stable fluids or something for solving the Navier-Stokes equation. It is a macroscopic numerical fluid solver with a very simple updating rules, and also in numerical perspective, it is an explicit method and can handle these very complex boundary conditions easily, and for the static or even the moving object inside your simulation domain. It has an inherent parallel scheme for easily hardware acceleration, such as GPUs, clusters, CPU clusters, or supercomputers. Okay, so first, we introduce a little bit on this Navier-Stokes equation. It is a famous equation to model the macroscopic behavior of fluid. Introduced more than 100 years ago, and it has this, generally we refer this equation to these two equations. The first is the conservation, and the second one is, because in visualization and graphics, usually most cases we consider the incompressible fluid, so the second one is the most important one to model the momentum change. And here we use rho for the density of the fluid, and u as the velocity of the fluid. And this P is flow pressure. And big F is the external force. Okay, so usually for this partial differential equation, you need to use a finite difference or finite volume or all these numerical methods in physics to solve it. And in graphics, it's a very famous stable solver that is not very accurate, but is very efficient and achieve very great success in the graphics. Okay, so next we introduce what is the Boltzmann equation to solve this equation. Okay, so first, from the very basic physics, we know that a fluid you can consider as a very large group of particles is moving inside, right? Without any external effects, so these particles were moving in any direction randomly. Okay, so we want to use this perspective to model the fluids. So generally, we want to use a computer to simulate. Therefore, we have to regulate that these particles can only move in a group of links to its neighbors. So we introduce this lattice. And this lattice site is the intersection point. And lattice link means from one site along this edge to its neighbor. So this one shows a very basic 2D lattice link. Therefore, this particles can only move in along these edges or links. Okay, based on this, the Boltzmann equation is introduced to model the macroscopic behavior of fluids, but it is based on statistical physics. It describes the statistical distribution of one particle in a fluid. So here F we consider as the probability distribution function, that is, in this image, the group of particles can only move from one side to maybe, for this case, to its four neighbors. Then you can consider if at the beginning, at this side, you have 100% particles. So maybe from statistical physics, they have the probability to move along each link. For example, maybe to right, you have 60% possibility to move in that direction. So this is we introduce this small f here to model this probability distribution function. Then this is described by Boltzmann, and then in this equation, the big sigma is the change due to the collision. Because when your particle is moving, the particles will have the effect to collide with each other. So when you model this procedure of physics, you have to consider this collision. Okay, so anyway, we use this big sigma to model this collision. And this v is a particle velocity moving from one side to another. Okay, so this is a theoretical Boltzmann equation. It has been discretized on a lattice to model the fluids, and then it is what we call the lattice Boltzmann equation. So this lattice Boltzmann equation is to model the probability distribution function of all these particle populations on each link at each site. It is, for example, this Fi, Rt, R is a lattice site, T is a time step. And this Fi, excuse me, is the particle distribution from one site to another neighbor along the link I, because you go right is zero, go up is one, something like this, so you have your I here. So the original one, FRT, is modified by the omega function, and then the result, what we usually call the post-collision result, is streaming. That means the post-collision result will propagate along the link to its neighbor, right? The neighbor is modeled by this R plus delta T times EI, because EI is a vector from R to its neighbor, and then this delta T is the time. So we get the next step result, FIR, at the time t plus delta t. So this is a basic equation for lattice Boltzmann method. It can recover the Navier-Stokes equation with the mathematical method based on the Chapman-Escock analysis. And we have a limitation that it can only model the low Mach number fluids. For high turbulent one, more method will be introduced. However, in most cases in graphics and visualization, we model the fluid is in this limit. Okay, so here we introduce a little bit detail on this lattice. This is a very basic example for the 2D lattice. So this one, we model that for each link from one side to its neighbor, there is a Fi, its probability. That's like this. So you have your site, the site will have the links to its four neighbors and also including itself, because some particles will tend to stay at this current site. So generally speaking, we have in this case D2Q5 lattice. That means we have this method in 2D and we have five links for each lattice site, like this one. Okay, so this Fi have the meaning is that you do the summation of all the Fi around this link, around this site. So finally you get this macroscopic fluid density. So that is very easy computing. So generally, Lesser-Boltzmann method is use some method to update this Fi for each site at each link, and then from this Fi you can compute the macroscopic fluid density as well as the velocity. We'll show later. Okay, so we have this basic lattice. Then for each site we have five, in this case, links. So generally we have something like this. For each site we have five links. Then we need to do the collision, right? At each lattice site, we need to implement this big omega in the way that it is conserving the mass and the momentum as locally. Okay, so usually this big sigma can be very complex if you really want to model the physical collisions between all these particles. This BGK model is a simple version and very popular. That is, for each Fi at each site, we assume that there exists a local equilibrium distribution values, FEQ. That this EQ is only dependent on the density and the flow velocity. That is, if your flow is reaching its equilibrium, it will have no external effects, so this FEQ is a constant value. So, but we have this Fi is different from EQ. So this collision is modeled as a relaxation procedure in statistical physics, which we show here. So it's a very easy computing, and this tau here is called a relaxation time, and it all usually used to determine the viscosity of the fluid, which is a very, very important physical properties of the fluid. Okay, so usually the LBM equation is computed in two stages. First is the collision that we have shown that use this relaxation computing. Then the propagation or streaming, that is the result after collision, is propagate along the link to its neighbor. So you can see the basic computing is very simple. And here I introduce a little more detail. That is, for each link like this, after collision I change the color a little bit, means it is a post-collision result by this equation. So you can see this collision computing is local. It has no relations with its neighbors. So you can only apply this computing to each Fi locally. Then for the whole lattice, that is, collision is applied to all its link for each Fi. So for this one, it applies to the five links. Then this BGK FEQ is usually modeled by this second order polynomial equation based on the rho and the u, that is the density and the velocity. You can use the previous step result to compute the current equilibrium status, then to update the next step result. And this big A, B, C, D are all the constants. It's defined by the lattice geometry. That is, if you determine that you use D2Q5, then this A, B, C, D are just some constants, so it's very easy to compute. Okay, so this is what we have at the beginning. So after collision, we get the result like this. I just changed the color a little bit. That means we finished our collision locally. Then next, is streaming. Streaming is the post-collision distribution functions are propagated along its link, because it is the value on each link. Then it moves along that link to its neighbor, like this. So the values on the right, that the right side's link will be modified by this one. And this one will move to this neighbor. This one moves to this neighbor. The same thing for this. And this center one is this low. It will stay there, because that one actually representing the particle distribution that want to stay there. Okay, so for the whole lattice, the streaming result looks a little bit complicated like this. However, if you look one, for example, you look at the red one, it starts from this, and moves to its four neighbors. At the same time, for the right link, you can see the right link in last step is moved to the right, and it is replaced by the link from its left, because that one will also move its right link result to its right neighbor. Okay, so actually, you can see that this update everything simultaneously, because it have no conflicts. It just replace the values at a different position. So this streaming actually is easily implemented and only involves this neighborhood, small neighborhood, because it only moves the link along the link to its immediate neighbor. Okay, during this, we find some problem, right? Because someone is moving outside, someone on the boundary cannot, you don't know, it's undetermined, because in the middle it should be moved from this direction to this direction. However, on the boundary you cannot determine their values because of our simulation domain is limited, right? So this is a boundary problem for all the numerical method. You have to handle a special case for boundaries. This is a inclination. This one moves correct, no problem. This one is no problem. This one is move outside. So usually we just discard that because it's move out of our simulation domain. And this one is correct. However, we need to determine some values that it should virtually move from here to this position. However, we don't have that value. So that is what we need to determine, how to define this value. Okay, so there are many methods to define this, such as the periodic method, outflow method, and bounce back method. Bounce back method is a very popular way to implement this. It's like this. We consider that this moving out of the values moving out of this range will hit some virtual wall here, and it's bounced back, because it's like a, some, you can consider it as a group of particles moving outside, then it bounced back by some wall. It's like this. Okay, so this value can be used to define this incoming value that we don't know. So this is a basic idea on how to implement this very basic bounce back method. So you can consider it's quite easy. You just assign this value to this inverse link direction. So this is a basic way to handle the boundaries, the bounced back result. Okay, in general, that is the boundary condition for the surrounding wall. However, sometimes we want to model the internal object. The internal object can be any arbitrary geometry shape inside your simulation domain. So in that case, we also consider that as a wall for each link. For example, this edge of the boundary is cutting of a link from this one to this neighbor. Okay, so here is some kind of a wall here. So we apply the same strategy as bounce back. However, it's not that simple. You compute directly assign that value. But anyway, from this you can assign a value for that one, because it cannot go into the object. So you have to define this value as well. So usually there are many approaches for this, but the most popular are some kinds of local interpolation. That is, you want to set this green value, we just look in this local neighborhood around this cutting boundaries. It's very close to this neighborhood, and then use the values to some some kind of linear interpolation to define the values. It's not hard, it's just some implementation with some local interpolations. So anyway, the basic strategy is still the method used in the bounce back. So this one actually shows that this advantage of lattice Boltzmann method is it can easily model these internal and external boundaries with this very basic local computation. But for the traditional numerical method, finite difference, finite volume, for these kinds of boundaries, you have to spend a lot of time on coding these special cases. It's a hard problem. Okay, so we have introduced a basic two stages of solving this LBM mass equations. Okay, so here we just use this D2Q5. This is the simplest case. Sometimes people prefer to use this D2Q9 lattice structure. That is, we also include the links from each side to its diagonal neighbors, not just immediate axial neighbors. For 3D, you can also choose a different lattice structure. For regular Cartesian lattice, we know it have at most 26 immediate neighbors. And then, including itself, we have 27 possible links. So you can define a D3Q27 lattice structure. And usually, these kinds of links in 3D can be categorized into four subgroups according to the length of the link. Right, you have the length is 1 or square root 2 or square root 6, square root 3, sorry. Then we have this Q0 to 3, we have these four groups. Then these four groups, you can choose a different combination between the groups. For this one, this is a very popular one we usually use in the D3Q19. We include the first three groups. We have 18 links to its neighbors and including one of itself. And sometimes people prefer to use the D3Q13, that is, we only choose the first and the third group. So this is the lattice structure. Generally speaking, these large discrete velocity groups, that means we use the D3Q27, for example, will give the accurate result and it's more stable. But sometimes we want to use the smaller size of this group that is some kind of approximations, but it will use less memory and as well as improve the performance of your computing. So it depends on the application requirements of your accuracy and your speed and memory requirement. Okay, we have introduced how the two stages is used to model the FI. Then this FI is used to compute the macroscopic properties of fluid that we are interested. For example, this density we just discussed is just a summation of all the FI for each lattice site. And the U is a summation of all its momentum along each site. So FI is a population value and EI is a vector direction. It is normalized by the density value. And then the tau, the relaxation time, scale is used to determine the viscosity of the fluid. Okay, so based on this, we have finished the basic introduction of LBM method. So we can see it is quite easy to do the computation. Everything is local and explicit. Okay, we introduce a little bit on this recovery of the Navier-Stokes. It's a Chapman-Ascock expansion. You use a very small number, epsilon, for expansion for the Fi in order of epsilon, as well as to the partial derivative to the T and to the X, that is a spatial dimension. Then we use this analysis expansion method as well as the Taylor expansion on the LBM equation we write here. Then with some basic math, we get the result. According to the order of this small expansion epsilon, we get these equations. Then with summation, all these equations, this equation is for Fi. Then we do the summation, because summation of Fi will give you the rho, that is the density. and also do some math, we get this equation on the top. That one includes the pi 0 and pi 1 are the diffusion tensors, higher order tensors defined by the lattice structure. Okay, then finally, if we apply this lattice structure computing on this Cartesian lattice structure to the pi, then we can finally recover the Navier-Stokes equation in the limit of low Mach number. Okay, so that is a basic introduction for LBM. However, what we have introduced is just a special case in LBM. It is a single relaxation time LBM. It is only using one relaxation parameter, that tau, to determine the viscosity. Then it's used to change all this Fi from F0 to Fn in any n you use. It's simple and fast. However, it's prone to be unstable for the high turbulent fluid sometimes. Actually, people in physics introduced this new, more general LBM called multiple relaxation time LBM. So the SRT LBM is just a special case. So this one has improved stability, and they introduce multiple relaxation parameters. So each parameter can be used to control the mass, the momentum, the internal energy, as well as the viscosity. A brief introduction. So we have a group of Fi for each side, right, from F0 for to maybe F5 in 2D. So it is multiplied by this big M, it's a matrix. Then it is transformed to the space of its moments, its hydrodynamic moments, have their physical meanings. So usually this big M is a constant transform matrix if you have your fixed lattice structure. For example, this is a matrix for the D3Q13 model. You can see at the first line, at the first row, every element is 1. So it multiplies the F, then you can know that M0 actually is a summation of all these Fs. So we have discussed this summation of all the Fs is the density. So that means M0 actually represents the density. In the same way, we can see M0 is the mass density of the fluid, and F1, 2, 3 in this case combined together actually determines the momentum of the fluid in this particular site. And F4 has some meaning in the internal energy, and others are some higher order tensors. So in this way, this collision and streaming is performed as this one. So the collision, you can see, is the same as before, but it's applied on the M space. Moment space. So this MRT is relaxed to its equilibrium status. That is directed, or the speed is controlled by the big S. And then the result is transferred back by this inverse matrix of M to the F space. And then the streaming is exactly the same as before. So this S is a diagonal matrix of a group of relaxation parameters. And this Si, if all the Si you use the same value, that is recover the previous SRT LBM. And each S actually have some physical meanings. For example, the S6, if you use the D3Q13, S6 actually have the meaning of related to the kinetic viscosities. And others can control the different parameters. So it's more easier for this to couple together with the physics. Okay, so we use these fluid methods to solve to do the simulation. The main driving force in most cases are the body forces. For the SRT LBM, usually the body force can be added in this way. It is like we introduce the post-collision. We have the post-collision result here. This is a post-collision result. Then it is modified by a momentum factor introduced by this big F, its external body force. The big external body force actually is applied to all the I, each I, that by the product, that is actually the projection from Fi to this link EI direction. And this B and the tau are just some coefficients used to scale its values. Okay, for the MRT-IOBM, we have introduced that some of the moments actually represents the momentum. This momentum can be directly modified from this big F, external force. It's just a very basic Newton's law that you modify your momentum by adding the body force times the delta T. So this is a method of applying the body force. And also we know the temperature and thermal effects is also very important for the fluid dynamics. Usually the temperature evolution is modified by this advection diffusion equation, which is solved independently from LBM. And then for SRT-LBM, we can add this temperature effect by a buoyancy force. So the buoyancy force can be defined by this difference between this current temperature and the reference temperature, and this G is a direction of the gravity. So if we define this buoyancy force, we can apply this force to the LBM computing. And for MRT-LBM, we know that there is a moment actually represents the energy term. The energy can be modified by the temperature because that's the internal energy of this fluid. This J here is a momentum. So actually this energy's equilibrium status is determined by the rho is the density, and the J is the momentum, and the T is the temperature with some parameters. Okay, so we have finished the basic introduction of all the LBM issues. Then it is explicit and local computing method for fluid dynamics. So we want to solve it in the graphics hardware. So this hardware is some chips in graphics cards. Right now it is widely used, not only for the games and movies, but also for the general purpose computing. That's our case. So this is from NVIDIA, that they claimed the increasing speed of the GPU comparing to the CPU is still very large, as well as the estimation. And also they have some numbers to show that they increased faster than the CPU. However, right now I think the NVIDIA and the Intel is do some wars on this. The Intel is also want to do something similar to this. Okay. Anyway, what we want is to use this graphics pipeline for our parallel computing. So generally, this graphics pipeline can do the computing simultaneously for the multiple data elements. And also, this data elements is processed independently. If you have your computing that is generally local and only involves maybe a small neighborhood, that is very great for this graphics hardware acceleration. And also, this graphics hardware can achieve very fast speed with this low requirement of the control management work. It is shown here some of the architectural issues that we can see that the thread processors is increasing a long time on GPU. And generally, contrast to the CPU, that they use more transistors on computing because instead of management. Because in CPU is a very general processing unit, you have to spend a lot of resources on management work. So GPU can only handle some special cases work, so they can use more these chip space on the computing and use less cache. So it can reach a relatively fast speed. Okay, so here our LBM is a very perfect stream computing model. It has a very high degree data parallelism because every computing is local and only involves the immediate neighbor. And it can capture the computational locality and reduce this offsite computations. On the GPU, we know there are a lot of programming tools. Usually we use CG, and however right now we are working on using the CUDA to improve the performance maybe. Here is a basic GPU algorithm. So starting from the beginning, we have the particle distributions. Okay, the particle distribution and the density velocity. These are the initial stage. Then this density and velocity is used to determine the FEQ, the equilibrium values. And then this equilibrium value is applied in collision together with the original Fi, that very simple collision result for each element, each link. Then it is streamed to its neighbor, where we get a new distribution for each lattice site, right? Each lattice site gets a link value from its neighbor, so it, they get a new distribution. Then we need to handle the boundaries as well as the outflow conditions. Then we get the final next step result, and it's used to update your previous data structure, maybe in the texture memory, and then to do this loop, this iteration. So this is a basic GPU algorithm. Actually, it is implemented here. We first store all the FI data in LBM inside this texture memory, and using the GPU kernels to do the computing inside the fragment processors, and we get a result from frame buffer and read back to the texture memories. So this is a loop that's similar to the GPU algorithm. So it is the implementation of this LBM. Here we introduce a little bit on the CG programming, because right now I think a lot of people try to use CUDA. So CG generally have more headache. Here is for each site you have, for example, 9 links. So you have to group them together, because for each texture it has the limitation of only 4 values there, right? RGBA. So you have to do a grouping with some rearrangement. So for D2Q9, you need at least 3 textures. And for the D3Q19 data, to save in the GPU textures, you need at least 4 volumes in the texture, right? Because it's 4 times 4 is for the 9, I think it's 5. There are another one you need to store the velocity and density. Usually in the CG programming, we do the flattening to store that into a 2D texture. Therefore, we need some transformations between the 3D world coordinates of your data to the 2D flattened texture coordinates. Okay, I will not go into detail on that, because right now, maybe you use CUDA, you do not need to handle that. So these are the very basic 2D example we use to show the method result with some very basic geometry inside. If you introduce a bar, you can introduce more turbulence to your simulation. Yeah, that's the very typical fluid dynamics. It is not symmetric because of you using the fluid dynamics to solve this. This is a very classic result. It's not symmetric. Theoretically, it should not be symmetric. Okay. This is a 3D example. Actually, we use a D3Q19 on the GPU for the computing. Internal, it's a jellyfish result. This jellyfish is a dynamically changed, very complex geometry. So you can see this LBM computing can easily handle this dynamically changed boundary conditions. Actually, this is a 3D implementation we show here. You can see actually it's 3D with different cutting edge, cutting plane to show the particles. Actually, there is a paper, a chapter in the book of GPU GEMS 2, so you can find the details of these implementations. Okay. So we have introduced the GPU implementation. However, sometimes one GPU is not enough because the GPU have some bottleneck, I think, in their memory size. For the very large scale scientific simulation, it's not enough. So you have to use a cluster of GPUs and or CPUs. So in that case, there are some other issues. You have to handle this communication between the nodes as well as how to do the decomposition of your simulation domain. And I think Klaus will give us more details on how to do this cluster computing for the LBM acceleration. Okay, here are some references of my talk here, as well as thank many contributors to this result, and thank you very much. And before Klaus here, you have any questions for this? Yeah.
Any difference for the LBM
Actually, for the basic algorithm, we use the same, but for the NVIDIA GeForce, at the beginning, we use the CG. So you have to spend a lot of time on how to handle this packing of this data into your texture memories. But for this new architecture, I think it's more easier. You do not need to do it yourself to do this particular packing of your data stream. However, you need to focus on the CUDA system. I saw some paper, it's from physics world. They use GPU for LBM. Their focus is on boundary issues. And what they did is they tried to use the shared memory, for example, in CUDA system, use shared memory to store a small neighborhood. Therefore, inside this shared memory for this CUDA architecture might increase the performance. However, it's hard to determine what's this local area of shared memory because you have to handle the boundary issues. So I'm still thinking they are working on that. And also, Klaus will introduce cluster computing. We'll have the same issue, actually. Cluster computing is like you use a group of threads, but it's on different machines. You need to handle this boundary and the decomposition issues. That is no different. I didn't. Yeah. Simulation itself. Thank you. Yeah.
Do you need to impose any constraint to make sure your X are non-negative?
Yes. You are right. This is because LBM is an explicit simulation method. So in all the explicit numerical method have some limitations. It's similar to that very famous CFL conditions. It's not in that case, but it's similar that your tau value have a limitation. For example, it cannot be smaller in the BGK model, smaller than 0.5. If in that case, it will blow up your simulation. Your FAR will reach negative values. It's not valid. So that is also the limitation of your recovering of the Navier-Stokes equation also have the same issue. So it's for all the explicit solver, you need to handle this. Because we do this streaming from one side to another, this streaming speed should be smaller than the speed of sound of your fluid. So that's the limitation. So for practical computing, it's a limitation on the values of tau. The tau should be in some range. Is that correct? My answer. Thank you. Any more questions? Okay, please. Yes. You mean the jellyfish dynamics? Yeah. The jellyfish actually is we use some kinds of geometry mesh, but it's a dynamic mesh. Yeah, this one actually is is the last one. You can see it's a chapter in the book GPU GERMS 2. Okay, thank you. Yes, please. This one does not have a large size. It's kind of like the, it's around 80 cubic, something like that. So in our practice, it's if you have a simulation domain is bigger than 128 cubic, it's a headache. You want to use GPU to accelerate because of limitation. But right now, you know, GPU is increasing their memory. But for if you want to do a scientific simulation, usually, for example, use 1,000 cubic. You need multiple computers. Klaus, I think, will introduce this. Okay. All right, thank you. Ask Klaus to be here. It's two.
My name is Klaus Igelberger. Well, you see, I'm from the University of Erlangen-Nürnberg, and I'm in the group of Professor Rüde. The group of our chair is called System Simulation, so we're mainly dealing with simulation systems, for example, fluid simulation. Therefore, we are also interested in this, that as well as on that. So let me start with a question. How many of you have already dealt with lattice Boltzmann so far? So not so many. Okay. Then I'll definitely not skip the basic things, but more or less concentrate on the basic stuff. Unfortunately, I have only half an hour to explain a topic that I could probably speak an entire day on. I'll try to do the best I can in this half an hour, give you a short introduction to what you could do in order to improve the performance, what is necessary to do a large-scale lattice Boltzmann simulation on clusters. But unfortunately, I have to skip some things that may be interesting. You can probably...
You have 40 minutes.
Okay, 40 minutes, perhaps. That's a little bit better, but still I will not be able to cover everything. So I'll give you some references at the points where I simply cannot go into more detail. All right. What I've planned, so you already got an introduction to the lattice Boltzmann method, so let me just give you some more, a few back to what you already should know by now for those things that will be necessary for the optimization part. So then there will be a short motivation part, simply because you may ask yourself, why is it necessary to do this optimization stuff anyway? And then I've picked some optimization techniques that may be, well, the most important ones. And then, especially, there is the parallelization part, because this is what we're interested most in. We're not only doing simulations on small, but, well, large-scale grids. I'll come to this in a second. All right, I should stick here, because here's the microphone. Okay. Let me remind you of some facts about the lattice Boltzmann method. So this is just some images about what we are doing in our group. So there are free surface simulations here and here, so free surface perhaps also in combination with moving objects. There are some moving object simulation here, for example, also with electrostatic and electromagnetic potentials, and perhaps some multiple objects of arbitrary shape floating in the fluid. So the most important fact about the simulations we're performing is that they are large scale, meaning we're interested in not only 80 cubed, but perhaps these 1,000 cubed or even more lattice cells. And this means that our limitation is mainly the main memory. So we need as much main memory as we can get. Some simulations, like perhaps those, need up to, the largest simulation we've run so far was 39 terabytes of main memory. So if you have terabytes, and unfortunately graphic cards are not longer something you can use, then you have to stick to the largest computers you can get. So this is one of the reasons why we're interested in this optimization. If you're using large computers, then, well, large computers cost money, and especially the time you're spending on this machine costs a lot of money. So the faster your code is, the less money you have to spend on that. So one basic reason, and especially, well, since we're also computer scientists, performance optimization is something we're always interested in. So this is something you've already seen in the previous talk, the basic Boltzmann equation that is directly discretized to form the so-called discrete Boltzmann equation. So I think this is something you should remember. A fact that I should stress now is that there are basically two steps. So there's this collision step, which results in, well, new distribution functions in every cell, and there's this stream step. So logically, you can divide those two steps, separate them from each other. So do first a collision step in all cells, and then do a stream step for all cells. Okay? So one of the important things is that the stream step, if you're just taking the stream step as a separate step, introduces a certain data dependency, unfortunately. So best is if I'm just going to the next slide and show this again on a visualization of the D2Q9 model. If you're taking, for example, this link here, so from this cell there's something flowing, so since we have particles, to this cell. Every distribution function is stored somewhere in a memory location, so if I'm taking this distribution function and stream it here, it may overwrite the value I have here, if this here has not already been streamed here, and so on, so you have sort of a data dependency. This is, unfortunately, a big limitation if you want to do an optimized, well, lattice Boltzmann simulation. The easiest way to handle this is just to allocate two grids, so sort of a source or destination, or grid one, grid two, whatever you want to call them. One is the old grid, and all new distribution functions are streamed into the new grid. So this is the easiest way to handle this data dependency. Okay, just as a reminder, the D2Q9 model uses 9 distribution functions in every cell, so every cell holds exactly 9 values. So on a graphics card, it's probably single precision. However, for scientific simulations, you will probably need double precision, meaning that every cell stores 9 double values. This is already quite a lot of memory. However, again, as a reminder, the D3Q19 model, so the three-dimensional model that most people use, already has 19 distribution functions. And then it suddenly starts to get really, well, cramped in the memory. 19 distribution functions per cell is quite a lot, and especially if you are now thinking about the giga cube, meaning 1,000 cubed, this is really a huge amount of memory, especially, yeah, as I said, you need two grids, so it's not only 19 but 38 distribution functions per cell. This is really a lot of memory. Okay, then you might think, why this optimization? This is something you all should know, Moore's law. This is, well, pretty old by now. However, it's still true. So Moore predicted that every 12 to 24 months, so on average 18 months, this number of transistors on a chip double. Well, this is still true. So we have a speed growth of roughly 43% per year. So just taking a look at this graph, and you may wonder, why is it necessary at all to think about performance? Let's wait 2 years and we have a process that is twice as fast. Isn't that easier? However, next to the processor speed, we have another increase of speed. This is the DRAM speed. Whereas the CPU speed doubles every 2 years, the performance of our main memory only doubles every 6 years. And this so-called memory gap is increased pretty fast, actually. So since I told you we need a lot of memory, and our simulation is definitely memory bound, you have to take into account that the performance speed we gain by new processors is definitely not enough to, well, to bridge this DRAM memory gap, right?
So think about optimization of the Lattice-Boltzmann method as a sort of memory optimization. Yeah, the main optimization techniques will try to handle memory as efficiently as possible, because this is where actually we are losing performance due to this big gap of the memory. All right. Then another nice graph taken from Intel, which actually shows nicely why relying on increased processor speeds is not true anymore. So if this is, well, just a normalized processor, if I'm just overclocking this by 20%, then I perhaps gain something like 13% in performance increase. Not bad. However, what's pretty nasty is the increase in power I need. If you're taking a look at the formula, the frequency of the processor is, well, there's a square to the frequency in the computation of the power. So 73% more power for just 13% more performance, that's pretty bad. So this is basically the reason why people are going multi-core. Think of underclocking a single core by 20%, then you're gaining a lot of power in a way. And now just use two cores instead of a single one. Then you have approximately the same performance in the end, if you're using them in a wise way. However, you've still the power consumption of your, well, one core that it previously had. So this is basically the reason why relying on faster processors is not valid anymore. You should definitely think about optimizing code for a single core and then go multi-core, meaning parallelization, either for shared or distributed memory systems. Right, so much for the motivation. Let's do optimization techniques. At this point, I should mention, if there are any questions, please ask immediately. I think it's more important to handle immediate questions than to stick to even more complicated schemes. All right. Okay, so again, a reminder, the D2Q9 model, now I've colored all these distribution functions in a single cell. The first, and I think one of the most important messages is, in order to be able to gain performance, you should use a linearized memory layout. So you have two variants, two possibilities. One is the so-called collision-optimized data layout. Collision-optimized because we are now sorting the distribution functions according to cells. So we are storing the distribution functions of a single cell adjacent to each other. So this cell here, the 9 distribution functions, it might be the block until this point here. So 9 distribution functions closely together. Collision-optimized because in a collision, you need all 9 distribution functions in the 2D case of a cell, and they're directly handled. So if you're loading a single, perhaps some more cache lines, then all values for a single cell have been loaded, and you can pretty fast access all the values. This is pretty efficient. Therefore, this is collision optimized. There's the other another possibility called propagation optimized data layout. Now we are sorting the distribution functions according to the direction. So all the north distribution functions, center distribution functions, this may be the southeast distribution functions, are adjacent to each other, meaning if you're now trying to propagate the distribution functions, then you've already loaded all the values you need. Meaning, for all the cells, I've loaded the, center distribution functions. They don't have to be streamed, for example. Then the southeast distribution functions, if you're streaming, then you already have loaded the correct memory position and can pretty efficiently access the memory locations. Okay, so this is the one important message. If you're using Fortran, so depending on what you want to do, then this is something you automatically get, probably. If you're using something like C or C++, you have to do this manually because multidimensional arrays are, not part of the language per se. So this is, as I assume that most people are using C or C++ or something similar, this is something you really should do in order to get performance at all. Multidimensional arrays don't work that nicely. Then the second important question or message I want to give is that you should fuse the stream and collide step. So I said logically these two steps are separate. So you can traverse the entire grid once, do collision in all cells, you can then traverse it a second time, do the streaming step. However, it's way more efficient to handle stream and collide as one step. So you may have the for loop, your time steps, whatever, stream step, collide step. Replace this by a stream collide step. This is definitively way more efficient. As I said, we are memory bound, so we have to load all these values to our cache, then work on it, then write it back to main memory. If you're doing this ordering, so doing first a stream step, then a collide step, I've traversed all data values two times at least, which means every value is loaded at least two times. In this case, I can, well, if I handle every cell after another, do stream and collide for every cell, I only traverse my grid once. This is obviously way more effective. Okay, let's start with sort of a performance metric. Let's assume that we have a performance code, a lattice Boltzmann code available that has a performance 1, so sort of a normalized lattice Boltzmann code. So this clearly depends on the architecture you're using. This clearly depends on the compiler and the compiler flags you're using, perhaps also the programming language that you're using. Let's just don't go into details here and just assume that we have a code that has reasonable performance and we normalize this to 1. So this code definitively already contains one-dimensional, perhaps manually linearized array for my data. It has a fused stream and collide step. And, well, as I said, it has one of the settings for machine, compiler, and compiler flags. All right. So the first thing we definitely have to do is the single core optimization. There are a couple of techniques, and this is a point where I cannot go into detail. This would probably take too long. However, I definitely have to name them. So the first optimization is compiler optimization. You can turn on some flags. This will probably give you some performance increase. There's loop unrolling, loop fusion, and especially arithmetic optimizations. So if you're taking a close look at the formulas, you can very easily reduce the number of arithmetic optimizations by a factor of 2 approximately. So an EVE implementation and an optimized implementation, our arithmetic optimizations are easily done. And then also a technique called reduction of common sub-expressions. As I said, I cannot go into detail and give more examples of them. I think you can easily look them up in whatever optimization book you have available. However, this already gives you a considerable performance increase. So, easily 100%. So reducing the number of arithmetic optimizations is something you probably always have to do if you're optimizing code. So one of the very, very first steps. All right. Now let's handle... let me introduce something called blocking. Perhaps you know this from some other performance optimization stuff. This is a technique that is definitely not only related to lattice Boltzmann optimization, but something that is a way to efficiently optimize the use of your caches. So we're trying to increase the so-called spatial and temporal locality. So data we have once loaded into the cache should be reused as often as possible, meaning we don't want to load from the main memory every time we need the data, but we want to reuse the data that we have already loaded. The idea behind this is you must load cache lines. This is how the architecture works. And in a cache line, there are several data values. So if we have loaded some values, let's use all of the values we've loaded, not just a single one. So there are two techniques. One is called three-way blocking. Three-way in this way stands for three-dimensional blocking. So we're using three dimensions to block. So this is actually very easy to implement. This is why I'm stressing this technique. I would guess that if you have a similar code to what I'm showing, you need something like 10 minutes, and this optimization is done. and it gives you good to very good performance improvement, again, depending on the architecture you're using. And the nice thing is this is probably applicable everywhere. So every Lattice Boltzmann code should be, well, should be able to be optimized by three-way blocking. And there's another blocking technique called four-way blocking. In this case, we are doing, well, not only doing it spatial blocking, but also sort of temporal blocking. This is the sort of fourth dimension. It's slightly more complex to implement, however, it may give you even more performance than the standard three-way blocking. Unfortunately, it may not be applicable in your code. So depending on what application you're running, time blocking may not be an option. So if there are some, well, other things that you have to consider in your time loop, except stream and collide step, then this unfortunately does not work anymore. Okay, let's take a closer look at three-way blocking. So the idea is basically very simple. So let's start with a left lower front cell and just work our way toward, along the cells. Normally we would just update one row after another, and if one entire plane is updated, we would go to the next plane and start with the first cell, update row by row again, and so on. So blocking just means we restrict ourselves to a small block. So this image here gives a good impression to a small block within my entire domain. So instead of updating every cell in a row completely, I stick to a short part of this row and then go to the next row here. So I update three cells, then go to the next row until the entire small plane is finished. Then I go to the next plane until my block is finished. So if you're continuing your scheme, in the end, ultimately we have updated the entire domain once. So there's no difference in the result as if we would update cell by cell. Okay. So why does this work so nicely? In order to update a cell in a stream collide order, I need the values from the surrounding neighboring cells. So remember, we're streaming from the surrounding cells to the center cell. I definitely have to load those values from... Let's go back once because the pictures may be nicer. So an update to update the center cell here, I have to load all the surrounding cells, meaning I have to load this entire mini block here anyway. Okay? So this block has already been loaded to cache. If I'm now just walking on, updating every cell by every cell, then these values are probably thrown out of cache again because, well, the cache is too small to hold everything, especially if you're doing large simulations. If we are restricting ourselves to work on this block here and update every cell in this small block first, then all the values that have been loaded into cache can be reused because, well, we're working on them again. So this is the whole idea of this technique. Let's take a look at a short code. So I'm using the C or C++ syntax, whatever you prefer. So in Fortran, this may be very similar. So you're probably using three for loops, so three dimensions, because three dimensions is the most interesting part, with a by one increment here, and we are just updating the cell. So this is sort of the basic code you have. What you have to do in order to have three-way blocking is just to add another three for loops. Blocking basically means to add another for loop for every for loop that you're blocking. Since we're blocking all three for loops, we have three new for loops. These three for loops are now running over the blocks that I have, and the inner three loops are now just running in the blocks I have. So for every block, I'm doing an update of every cell in this block. Actually, pretty simple. Something, as I said, that can be done in mere 10 minutes. The only thing that you have to introduce here is something like this block size. Block size may be, well, an arbitrary value that you are choosing to adapt the code to your actual machine. So if you have a very large cache, this block size may be larger. If you have a very small, well, second level or perhaps even now third level cache, then this block size may be smaller. So it completely depends on your architecture. However, you can tune this to well run optimally on your architecture. This is the nice thing here. If you have something like, okay, so the general guideline is that you have to think you need two small blocks to work on, so sort of the old block and the new block. Both blocks have to fit into your cache. So if your cache is something like 512 kilobytes large, then two blocks must fit into the cache, and you can say, okay, 256 for one block divided by three, so no, not divided by three, so something like 16, 30, something like 32 cubed. So, okay, so this block size is actually, it's actually not large, something like 16, 32, 64 perhaps, that's it. So the main cache is used for the distribution functions because this is definitively the largest amount of data you have. So sure, you should probably not choose the block size such that these two blocks are exactly fitting into cache, make it a little bit smaller. But depending on the application you're using, you may not have much overhead, or perhaps you have overhead. Okay. But this is the nice thing about this block size. You can tune it to your actual application. You should perhaps test it, so choose different block sizes and see how the performance behaves, but ultimately it's your choice what to choose here. Well, okay. All right. So this is the performance we gain by just introducing the three-way blocking. So another 40% performance increase is possible by just these three additional for loops. And I think this is something that, well, everybody should consider. It's easy, and it gives you a considerable performance increase. Let's take a look at this four-way blocking. So I said the idea is to just block another dimension. So in this case, the time loop. So the idea is, well, I've updated one block, all the cells in this one block. However, now I can update some cells again, simply because what I need in update in order to update a cell are just the values surrounding the cell. It's strictly local, it's explicit. So why not just update all the cells contained in this little block again? So this is what you see here. And well, I can still update another cell again, so this is what you see here. So ultimately, I have updated all the cells that I can in this block, three time steps, basically. Okay, then I cannot do anything anymore in this block, then move on with the next block. So first update, second update. In this case, we have to take care that all the cells that are contained in my first block that can be updated a second time are also updated. So second update in this case. So in the first time step, we did a single update of this one blue cell. Now we have three cells to update. And if I'm taking a look at the next block, then I even have four cells to update here. So it's a little bit more tricky to really update every cell, well, as many times as it's necessary. Okay? So this makes the implementation a little bit harder, but we can continue the scheme on and on until ultimately we've calculated three time steps. And you can definitively increase the number of time steps. This is just the limitation of this example, in one sweep of the grid. So this sounds like another very, very nice performance improvement, and indeed it is. However, depending on the application you're running, this may not be applicable, as I said. If you have some application coupled to your lattice Boltzmann simulation, moving objects, free surfaces, whatever, then you have something additionally to calculate in every time step, then you're probably not able to, well, calculate several time steps for the lattice Boltzmann simulation anymore. So although this is a very nice scheme and it perfectly works, well, there's the question of whether it's always useful or not. Okay, this gives you another performance increase of about 12%. Okay, so this is ultimately what we reach using four-way blocking in comparison to our basic code that we had. All right. Now, as I said, there is a problem in the amount of memory that we need. So 38 distribution functions per cell, this is really a lot of memory. So we also try to improve this by introducing a technique called grid compression. And this technique nearly reduces the memory that we need by 50%. Nearly, unfortunately, it's not exactly 50%, which would mean that we only need one grid, however, we still have this data dependency. And actually, it's a little bit tricky to implement. However, if I'm showing you some illustrations, it's perhaps easy to understand the scheme. So this is our current, valid block of data, okay? So what you've done before is not just allocate the size that we actually need, but we allocated one cell more in each direction. So basically, instead of, let's say, 10 by 10 by 10, we've allocated 11 by 11 by 11 cells, all right? Instead of, just as we did before, start the update in this cell, we're doing a reverse sweep of the grid and start here at the upper back right cell, update this cell, and shift the data by one to the upper right back. So this may not be very nicely visible. So it's actually shifted by a 1-1-1 vector in this grid. And all the values are written here. The nice thing is that we have not touched any of the values in our original grid. We have not destroyed any values. So we have the data dependency is still valid. We just do a reverse sweep, update every cell, so first in the upper plane, then in the next plane, and so on, until we've shifted the entire grid to the upper right back. Then we are finished. This was one time step. All right? Now, everything, since the valid data values are in the back, we have to start at the front, update this value, and shift it by a -1, -1, -1 vector, to the original position 0, 0, 0. Okay? Then, we're traversing the entire grid in the standard way, shift all the cells by this -1, -1, -1 vector, and then in the end, we end up where we have actually started. So this means we have not violated the data dependency. All the values are intact. We just have to allocate a little bit more memory than we would need for a single grid. However, the implementation now requires that you're aware of the fact, aware of where you are, whether you're here or here, and that you're updating the cells in the according manner. This is what, actually makes it a little bit tricky. However, depending on what language you're using, you can perhaps very nicely wrap this in some classes, functions, whatever, so that the implementation details stay hidden and it's still the same Lattice Boltzmann code, basically. All right. So now, depending on whether we are using this grid compression on three-way blocking or four-way blocking, this may give an additional speed-up. So this is the increase for three-way blocking and the increase for four-way blocking. This is something of about 10% memory performance improvement, simply due to the fact that we have to transfer less memory. Yes. It's also possible. You don't have to choose something like I did here, a 3x3x3 block. You can choose whatever sizes of the block you want to. It's advantageous to use a larger block size in X direction than in Y or Z direction. So I would make the innermost loop. So in my case, the innermost loop was the X direction. This is the direction you should choose the largest block size. But it doesn't have to be symmetric. That's the important message. Yeah. I used only a block size variable. You can use three variables. So block size X, block size Y, block size Z, whatever. And this grid compression here also works for four-way blocking. What I did not mention is that in if you're using four-way blocking, you perhaps need some more memory, simply because you have to shift for every time step that you're calculating by one. So if you have the four-way blocking by, let's say, three, then you need, instead of one, three additional layers. But it's still working very nicely. All right. Let's do a little bit about parallelization. Yes, some more time. Let me introduce, so I don't know how many of you know OpenMP. OpenMP is a very, very nice tool because it's, especially in this case, extremely simple to do a thread-based parallelization of your code. It's available on every Intel compiler and the GCC from version 4.2. And I think by now even for the Microsoft compilers and Windows platforms. So it should be available pretty much everywhere right now. And as I said, it's a thread setup based on some preprocessor directives. So as an example, a very easy example, imagine that we have a loop, something sort of a time loop, whatever, with 1,000 elements. I mean, I just want to distribute the calculation of whatever is done inside the loop to whatever number of processes. Process source in this case, not processes, since we have threads, okay? The only thing you have to do is to add this pragma directive. So it's just a pragma OpenMP, so OMP parallel for, which automatically parallelizes this for loop. It's nothing else. So this directive alone makes this for loop parallel. The only thing that you have to perhaps think of are whether or not you need some thread local variables. So in this case, the loop variable should be local for every thread. So you cannot use the same variable in every thread. So every thread needs its own local loop variable. So this is what this private class here actually does. So making this I thread local. And, well, now assuming that the threads are not colliding inside this loop, this is a perfect parallelization of this for loop. Just a single line in your code. So perhaps to mention, it's available for Fortran, C, C++, so these languages. So what you could do in Lattice Boltzmann is just a distribution of the data to several threads. So in this case, the outermost loop is the while loop. Okay. So what you're doing is just to put a pragma around the outermost loop, and this automatically now distributes the amount of data to the number of rows that you have to several threads. So if I'm parallelizing by two, the front part is calculated by thread one, the back part by thread two. Pretty easy. So this is how you could, for example, very fast use a multi-core CPU. Okay. Well, however, this is a shared memory parallelization, meaning that it's only valid for machines that can actually access the same memory. If you have, for various reasons, the desire to go to larger machines, perhaps because you want to run even larger simulations, or you want to run with more number of processes, then you have to use something different. You have to parallelize for distributed memory, and one of the ways to do that is to use MPI. MPI stands for Message Passing Interface, and well, unfortunately, it's a little bit more complex than the shared memory parallelization because now everything has to be really parallelized. Every process, in this case, now really process, knows only about his local part. Let me show this in a simple example. So this may be sort of this GigaCube example. So we have some floating objects here in the flow. We have an inflow from the left side, and well, we want just to calculate this. This may be 1,000 by 1,000 by 1,000 cells, and we have to distribute the data to the according machines. So what is usually done, and especially also working for the Lattice Boltzmann, because we have this local update scheme, we're just distributing the data to the different processes. So the upper box may go to CPU1, the next box to CPU2, and so on. So you have also to think about a parallel initialization. every process has to initialize the region that he actually possesses in a way. Okay? And every process now updates locally all the cells that are, well, that he owns. The only thing you have to think about now is boundary cells. So if this may be the main of a single process, then this process needs some, well, boundaries, meaning these values here resemble the values on the other process. And you have to exchange these values. So in order to update these cells here next to the boundary, you have to know the values on the other process. And this is done via this MPI, message passing interface. All these values here are now assembled in a message written to whatever buffer. This buffer is sent to the other process, and this process then now interprets this message and writes the values to the according location. So these four values here may go here. So not only values, but all the distribution functions in this cell that are necessary are copied to the correct locations in these four cells. So in addition to just updating, so collide, stream, whatever, you now have to pass the messages in between. In every time step, you have to pass all neighboring cells such that every process is able to update his local cells. All right. So, I hope I gave you a short but good introduction to what's necessary to do performance optimization for Lattice Boltzmann. So, one of the basic messages you should keep in mind is that the data layout is one of the most important decisions that you're doing. So right from the beginning, you should choose the correct data layout, unfortunately. Otherwise, you will not get good performance. Then fusion of stream collide is significant. Perhaps in some cases, it's not possible, also depending on your application. But if possible, you should definitely not avoid it. Then all these arithmetic optimizations, blocking, grid compression, and so ever can boost your performance by, well, 328%. So this is the graphs I showed you. And it's not that hard to parallelize it, especially using OpenMP, and if you want to go really for large scale using MPI. Okay, thank you. And I'm open for questions. Perhaps you can, the collide step is arithmetic bound or calculation bound, because in the collide step you're doing all the calculations. And this is the step you can speed up by these arithmetic optimizations pretty nicely. The stream step, however, is definitively memory bound, because you're not doing anything but copying values from one location to the other location. And in many systems, this stream step is, well, the slow step, so to speak. So if you're measuring collide step and stream step separately, and the stream step is the one that takes most time because, well, at this point you're memory bound. However, you're right, the arithmetic optimizations turn out to be a very, very nice optimization. However, it's also the first one I applied. Therefore, everything that follows probably doesn't give you exactly the same amount. So you saw that the steps grow smaller because you already have done a lot of optimization. So unfortunately, it's not going up by the same amount. But it's both in a way. So some people also claim that it's arithmetic bound, but due to this amount of memory that you need, unfortunately, I would claim it's a little bit more memory bound than, arithmetic. All right. Okay.
So we'll have a break. Thank you for coming back. We will resume at 10:30. Thank you.
Okay, welcome everyone to the second half of this tutorial. So I'm going to talk about mostly application side and weave in some of the physics that goes along with this. So the first, I want to start off with like, let's put this a little closer. Start off with some the classic method that by which this goes. So basically, you just have like some smoke densities on the grid nodes, and then you just advect it with the LBM method that you've heard about, and then the rendering you do just with traditional ray casting. Okay, but now the what happens here if you have like a only moderate grid resolution, then the smoke is just not going to look very realistic. Okay. If you have like only 30 by 32 or 64, it's just not going to look as dense as you want it to be. So you have to do some tricks. This was like our first attempt, really. This is like basically somewhat in the history of LBM in our lab, at least. And what we did was like we did the LBM on a very moderate grid. And then, which you see here, these are like streamlines around the table and the ball. And then we thought we need more detail for real realistic smoke. We need a little more detail than what you just seen. So when we went and just took pictures of fire as it was like time varying, like in, you know, all smoke. It's like a computer graphics, some of the computer graphics hack. And then just here you see some textures here of fire, different time frames of fire, and here different time frames of smoke. And then we multiply those by Gaussian functions. Okay. And then you just render this, right? You basically, what you do, you do OpenGL. This back then there was no CUDA or anything like this. You use OpenGL and you just clear the frame buff, and then you inject these what we call display primitives, these little textures that orient themselves with the viewpoint, with the view vector, the normal to the view vector. Just inject them into the scene, and then let them attract by the simulated flow field, and then the Gaussians will blend them very nicely. And we can switch the time frames. We can inject if we can, you know, animate them as they, you know, if we like. So it becomes very, very vivid, and so on. And then we composite them with vector front compositing. Okay, and then eventually these things expire as they go further. We can either like just let them expire, depending on some function, or we just let them expire because they go out of the field, visual field. So there should be some. They don't. There's no movies. No, these don't move. The next one moves, I see. Okay. Let's go back to the other one so we can see a little bit of this. This is back. I don't use. This is not my laptop. So yeah. So you can see some fire, right? So some campfire. You can play the banjo along with it, if you like. So some torch. Use a torch. You know, it looks like a little bit gamey, but notice this was like early 2000 or like 1990. So, you know, but it looked pretty realistic and it was quite cheap. It was interactive. Here's some videos. So you can like look at this. You know, you can see the smoke here. I moved the pointer away. See the smoke here. This boundary is moving. So I'll tell you next how to do moving boundaries. You have the smoke out of the box. And then here, like this smoke consumes this fire consumes the surface of the table. It just eats it away. So whenever it gets to, you know, it just travels along and then eats this away. I mean, this was like the first sort of first attempt to do this type of stuff interactively. Okay, I think I have to learn this keyboard. So now. So I showed you like smoke, but now let's inject some more stuff into this flow field, some hard objects, not just display primitives. Let's make the objects a little bigger than just little Gaussian splats, like what we said before, like a smoke bubble, like a soap bubble, or a feather. So how many guys, how many people here have seen like Forrest Gump? You know, there's this feather that goes around. Right, this was actually the inspiration for this, right? Yes. The Forrest Gump, yeah. Like. Ari Kaufman, who was the group leader back then, he said he saw that Forrest Gump movie and said we should put the feather there, you know. And then, so here you see the feather, and then this is actually NVIDIA lobby, with soap bubbles in front, and this is the flow lines of the smoke. We have some movies of this. You'll see in a second. And let's talk a little bit about this, how this goes, right? So what you have a, now you have an op, I'll take the other laser pointer, it's maybe better. You have an object here in the field, like the solid object here, and it moves and rotates, right? It moves and rotates. Those are like the two basic transitions, and you want to simulate these two velocities. Here's like the translation. Here's the rotation, angular velocity, and this attacks with the momentum here, right? There's this lever here, r plus 1/2 e minus r. That's that distance here. Okay, so. And then once you know this velocity here, which I tell you how to compute, you then change the distribution at the nodes. Like if this moves out, the distribution reduces, and if it moves in, it compresses. Right. So that's how you can get more energy into the system. Okay. And then you can compute these forces it has. Right. That you need here. Like this is the translation force, and this is the torque, the force that makes the angular movements. You can compute this here, like, you know, this is like very simple. It's just the sum of all the points here, and then here, this is the torque. You this is the cross product of the force times the lever it has, right? So this is the cross product, and that rotates the object in space. And once you know this, you can just take these two forces and map them simply to u and to angular velocity, because the mass and the length is unit, right? And then you can do this. Then you can do this type of movies here, like you can float bubbles in the wind field. I'll show you in a second. And you can also these bubbles. I mean, if you have soap bubbles, we had like this idea of, like, you know, these bubbles, they sort of vibrate a little bit. Like when there is force exerted on them, and the force lets go, then they start to vibrate a little bit. You know, there's an oscillation. And the way you do this, like, you know, the vibration, because it's sort of a circle, it's a spherical primitive. You can model the vibrations very nicely with spherical harmonics, because they operate on spherical. So you can, it's a harmonic, you can tune it, you can tell it like how much you want to vibrate. It's like a frequency, you know, like it's a spatial frequency, like a spherical frequency. And then you can tell exactly how you want this thing to react, right? So you can tune it, basically. You can say, I want it really fast, and you set these impedances very low, or you want it really slow, then you set the other impedance very high. And then you can model this deformation with these equations. And that controls the oscillations. Here you see the bases, the base frequencies here, the base harmonics, and these coefficients you can tell which behavior you want to have. So here's some videos here, okay? So that's what we computed. So here you see the spheric harmonics at work. Now this like has a certain stiffness. And the other, you see the force being exerted by this spray can. Where's the sound? There was like a very... I want to say, there was like a very nice tune, right? Yeah. Oh, yeah, okay. But there's some more, but we don't have any sound here, right? There's some sound that goes with it. Well, I spare you the sound. It's okay. So anyway, so you see this now, right? This is really how it goes. There's a lot of things here. There's a spheric harmonic modeling, then the force that exerts on the object, and I showed you the equations, and then the modeling actually of the advection, like how this reacts in the field that is there. Okay, so here's some more bubbles. Should that run now? Hang on, sorry. It should run by itself. Okay, so here you see the bubbles in the NVIDIA lobby. Also vibrate, and also notice the refraction effects that from the land, from the lighting. This is all there. So this was simulated. This was not. We didn't inject bubbles into NVIDIA lobby. This is like simulated with a static picture on the back. So. Of course, they also pop, you know. When they touch. Okay. So here's like this upward advection that comes from the heat that's here, and then also some. It can either be heat, but we'll talk about this later, or it can just be like some flow field that you put there, and then the bubbles exert get some force. they move around and they also rotate and they, and then they also vibrate according to the spherical harmonics. So it's like one application you can do with this. When was this paper? It was like in 2003. Right?
2003.
Yeah, 2003. So. In social agents, right? Was that TVCG or social agents?
SCA.
Huh? Yeah, right, right. So, okay, so now let's go to the feather. Okay, so here comes the feather. Again, a static image, and here, like, you see the feather. We model the feather like with a thin strip model. So there's like a thin strip model, and then this gets deforms depending on the force. And then there's gravity pulls it down, and the force exerted by the LBM flow field moves it back up. I think it's coming back. It's not coming back. Okay. So we don't have an end. So this is, the feather is gone. So that's like, you know. So this basically shows you like how you can combine different things into one application. There's the bending of the feather and the flow field. So once you have a flow field, a lot of things you can do. Performance. So this, notice again, this is like a very old G-force, okay? This is like from 2003 or 2002. It's like a G-force 4, which is quite old, actually. And these are the timings we got back then. Like 80, this is the grid size, 80 by 40 by 40, and then we actually got pretty good acceleration with the GPU. So this was one of those first papers that used the GPU for computational science. This was like, I think the Stony Brook group was one of the first groups that did that. Just map, because I think you talked about this already, right? How you mapped this. So that was like one of the first sort of things. We just needed some really cool demo applications, and that was one of them. So you get really good acceleration, like not quite an order of 10, but 5. So now let's go to melting and flowing, okay? That's like another thing. So now we're actually changing the state of an object. We're not just deforming things, we actually change the physical state. So so here we have, I'll show you how this works. So we can, like, you know, we can melt a foot, like when we, or we can pour some chocolate. So we can support like this sort of the holy grail of things, right? Solid melting, and then once it's melted, we can make the liquid flow. And then we can interact with make it interact with the ambient air. Like we can heat the air depending on the temperature that it emits. Okay, and then the behavior is controlled by the temperature, the body forces, and the viscosities of the medium. So we can still move things. Temperature can vary. Viscosity is also quite important. It affects a lot of constants. So we'll talk about all this. So the melting procedure. Okay. So here, this is like basically the Laplacian here. And we want to model the solid to liquid. And basically, whenever the solid turns into liquid, then the temperature has exceeded the threshold. Okay, that's pretty natural. And then the liquid and the air is simulated here. And then we can support different viscosities, different temperature evolution parameters, and we can modify this for correct motion. And so we don't do any front tracking, right? So that, like, when you read some SIGGRAPH papers, that many of these papers, especially for water, they do front tracking, like they track the front and they have very complicated models to make sure things are sort of stay within bounds. So we don't do that. So there's some movie, I think it should run away. Okay, so you can see like this. Skin is just shifting down. I mean, nowadays, this can, you can actually, nowadays, it's, the GPUs are so fast, you can you can really rotate and then influence the flowing and so on. You know, you can do all this interactively now. This is like, this is not as interactive back then. So the next thing is when you go, like, I think we went to a conference in the desert and we saw mirages and shimmering and so on. We were really excited and wanted to model this. And shimmering really is like you have a hot body like a bagel, and that bagel wants to radiate heat outside, out into the environment. Or you have this tractor here with the hot hood, and you can see these sort of vibrating, like these sort of, you know, like for movies, you oftentimes have this, right? This sort of, the air is somewhat shimmering, right? And it looks like, and then they put the very nice music in the background and so on. You have these very interesting effects. And then also here, you have this city that's actually there, but it really isn't. You have this mirage, like, right? This is like this lake that you think that there is, but there really isn't. And the same thing here. So you want to basically model this. There's just heat. It's just heat being emitted into the air, and then the rays, the light rays, they will bend and create like these illusions. That's all that happens. So you need two things. You need some infrastructure that dissipates the heat into the environment, and then moves it. And we can use the LBM for that. And then you need more infrastructure to model the light the illumination of the scene. So you need nonlinear ray tracing, because rays are no longer just linear. They get refracted by these different temperature gradients, right? And that's how the mirages evolve. Okay, so let's talk about like all these things. Like, number one, I'm not going to spend much time on the nonlinear ray tracing, because we use pretty much standard algorithms for this, which have been published. The contribution is more like how to get the heat into the environment and modify the temperature that you use for the LBM modeling. So heat transfer. Okay, so there's three effects. There's conduction, convection, and radiation. Okay, so there's like three things, right? So this is conduction when the temperature gradient exists. So here's the temperature gradient, and K is the thermal conductivity. The higher the conductivity, the more the temperature gradient will go and transfer the heat out into the area of the surface of the object. That's like one. So this is just basic conduction, okay? Secondly is the convection. That depends on, that's like sort of the motion of the fluid, the motion of the medium on the surface, between the surface and the medium. Like this, that has more something to do with the motion. And that you can model like this, that you need a temperature gradient between the flow, that's what's moving by, and the surface that's being heated. And the bigger that is, the bigger the thermal conductivity, the heat transfer will be. And we'll talk a little bit more about this H, this convection heat transfer coefficient. I'll have some more slides on that. Because this is the nice parameter where you can really control a lot of things. You can now you can model the surface that you're trying to have here. Right? The bagel may have a very different H than a truck hood, or like what you will want. So it depends, and this depends on the flow velocity, the distance, and the geometry of the objects. And that radiation is just this power of 4, temperature to power of 4, and that's also that also influences the heat transfer rate. So these four things, so three things you can model. Again, it's a function of the surface area. So let's talk about this heat transfer. Here, so you have like a very small area on the surface, okay, just a basis area here, and this x here is the thickness. Okay, that's what's called the characteristic length of the object. So that's where you can model the layer, how thick the layer is that you would like to use to transport the heat outside to the outside. So you can, that's what you can pick. There's like a surface quality that you can pick. And P is that point, okay? And here, this is the little area that we're talking about. And so we want to compute this convection coefficient H that I talked about before, that controls the convection. Okay, so there is a very interesting number that is rooted in physics called the Nusselt number, and it measures the enhancement of convection heat transfer. So when you look at this, right, nu, right, you can, nu is something that nu is a multiplies the Reynolds number with the Brundle, something called the Brundle number. Okay. And these things to the different powers. And Reynolds number that measures the The Reynolds number measures the in the inertial forces versus the viscous forces, like a ratio. It has no dimensions, okay, no units, and okay, and that basically large Reynolds numbers like means turbulent flow, and low Reynolds numbers means viscous flow around, right? So that's what you can do. So like over 4,000, it's like it's very turbulent flow, and then if it's lower than 4,000, lower than 2,000 is a viscous flow. So turbulent flow is somewhat challenging with LBM methods, right? So it's like, you know, that requires more than just a lot of high resolution. Bundle number, that measures, has also something to do with it's the kinematic viscosity. It's like it measures more the diffusion. So also low numbers they diffuse heat quickly. Okay, so this is the Nusselt number. This is what you input. This is what you specify, right? This is where you can model the flow and so on. But what you really want is H. So K is this the thermal conductivity. We talked about this before. Okay, we had that on the other slide here. Right here, there's the thermal conductivity that we specify. That's also and then this H here, this is the convection coefficient that we're going to compute, and X is characteristic length, right? So we put all this here, and U times K over X, then we get this convection coefficient that we were interested in, that we want to compute, and we can design it by this. Okay. So combine all this to compute H, what you said before, and then send the temperature of this point P at the surface for all points, of course, based on this. Okay, and this defines the thermal boundary condition for LBM. So then we make a temperature texture. I go through here. Back then you usually had color on surfaces, like in graphics hardware, usually you specify color texture or color vertices here as texture. And then we map the temperature for computation. Okay, so now we have a temperature texture basically. And then that's defined by the sun radiation and then all these other things. And well, these other things modify how the temperature is being transferred. Or by the user, you can just paint temperature if you like. And then comes this temperature-based ray tracing. So now we have the energy out in the field, and we modified the temperature gradients and so on. So now these temperature variations or these gradients that exist there, they change the refraction. So if you have a temperature here, a little less temperature here, then rays will diffract, right, from this. So they're bent, okay. And then that creates these shimmering effects and these mirage effects, because then they get really, really bent, and all of a sudden these rays pick up something from the ground, which looks like it comes from the top, so which creates then this illusion of lakes and so on, or the vice versa. It takes the sky and paints it into the ground, and then you think it's like a lake and you run there and want to drink, but you never reach. So it's like the very fatal things. So okay. So here are like some movies of this. Okay. You can see the asphalt. Looks pretty realistic. Is that it? Oh, I want to see that again. It was a lot of fun to do this project. It was cool. Do you have also a movie of the truck? Oh, okay, the bagel. Here's the bagel. The hot bagel, you know. Mona Lisa is getting hungry. That's pretty effective. So nonlinear ray tracing is also quite not that hard on GPUs. There's like a paper by Weisskopf, for example, that you can read. Or that's probably I like that one the best, but there's other papers as well. But it's not that hard to do. Here's the mirage. Now you can see the mirage evolve. See, you see the sky being all of a sudden here. It's really a little bit because the rays that you think go here are now going here, and they that's what happens. You shoot the ray, but it gets diverted here. And you think it would be here, but it grabs the lighting from the top. Again, this is a newer GPU, okay, 6800, which is still quite old at this particular point, because now we're like in the 280 GTX. Like, but this is a quite, this is actually pretty, like maybe 2 years old, 3 years old. And so you get like, you know, you get much better, you get higher rates, you get it for more complex effects. The rendering is still the rendering is the by far the most expensive part. So that the heat transfer and the modeling is actually much lower. Yeah, so you can get like five frames a second. Or 6 frames a second. So that's pretty good. You can actually roam around in the scene and look at it. Because the modeling and the ray trace, the modeling and the rendering is all two separate processes where you model, but then you can look at it from all directions. So there's really two processes. If you have two GPUs, one modeling, and you share the memory somehow, then you can do that. So you just run two different threads, the rendering thread and the modeling thread. So now let's, the one other project that's quite sort of successful in our group was the urban security project. So we live in New York City, so we, it's natural to sort of, back then in like 9/11 and so on, people became like very aware of like what you would do when there is like poisonous gas or like or hazardous poison in the air, and you want to warn people, want to do crowd control and make sure that people don't run into it, and they sort of, you know. So we will think, so there actually are sensors in New York City that measure these type of emissions, right? They're like sensitive to this. And then they have the report where there's like possibly something like that is contaminating the air, and then you want to know, but the sensors are somewhat, you know, they're somewhat sparse. So you want to know what where this may go. We also have smoke. We have also wind sensors, so you know where the wind blows, and so on. So we can, if we have such a model at work, we can sense the contamination, and we know where the wind will bring it. Then we can do crowd control, because we know, okay, you please do not go. You can tell police to guide the crowds into an area where most likely there is not going to be any contamination. So that was sort of the sales pitch, at least for this. So we had actually a web interface for this. So I'll tell you about this. So our system. So we model the airflow with these thermal effects. Then we transport the contaminants that may be in there. We actually did that. Actually do some experiments. There's the environmental ESL, Environmental Safety Lab, actually exists. They actually do experiments in New York City and track them. Well, it's not poisonous stuff, but it sends something that is sensitive to their sensors, and then they can actually do micro experiments and see if their models work well. So, and of course, there's very complex boundary conditions, buildings. I mean, there could be the butterfly effects of moving surfaces like trucks and then cars and taxis. I mean, for those who've been to New York City, it's a very busy place. And so you need to model all this if you really want to make if you really want to have a good prediction for this. So we actually have a large-scale simulation by like GPU clusters that we could hook up to the authorities, and they could like run our models and input the sensor data. So that's the plan. So and then we can visualize this, use the splatting to get more detail if you like, and have buildings that are realistically textured. So we were envisioning a virtual reality type of situation where you can actually immerse yourself into the scene, and you know, you sort of have orientation aids because these planners, city planners that will plan the crowd control, they have like, they can actually communicate with the people out in the field and could tell them where to guide people, because they both have the same view. So it's like a grounding type of grounding procedure where everyone sees what the other person sees. So you need good models so you can do the direction. So we worked on all these different things. And so we had two simulations we did. One is in the West Village. For those that's like, for those who know New York City, it's like the, you know, it's very, very touristy area. It's also a very beautiful area. It's like down Austin Street and sort of very central to New York. Not Wall Street. Wall Street is further down. And we have 10 blocks. We have like real geometry from the buildings, and about a color square mile, 1 meter of resolution. So it's not that amazing, but we do. So we can't model gargoyles and things like very intricate boundaries, but you can model like definitely windows. And lattice size, we use very small lattice size for this experiment. We'll have much more resolution later on. We'll see when we do a big scale simulation. So this is a 3.8 meter scaling. And then we this was like an earlier work on Ultra, on the 5950 Ultra. And these are the time steps. So we used 81 milliseconds per time step. Okay, so here's a movie of this. So here's like our little realistically textured block. And here are the flow lines of the flow. So we sort of know where things go. But in the you have to imagine what they do now. It's like they. It may look a little bit too video game-ish, but I have to say, like the people, what they mostly do, they do bloom modeling in these environments. They just have a bloom that just emits out. That doesn't take at all consideration of the building geometry and where the wind. But they have a wind model. But when you look at the, I show you some movies later on, like. The wind, these tall buildings, they guide the wind in very unpredictable ways. You need to model this. So, but they don't do this at all. But for this to model, you need to have interaction with the boundaries and so on. So. Okay. So it's like some close-up views. So we model. We also worked a lot on good texturing of buildings. I went actually around and I took build. It's sort of a approach where we use existing imagery, but we tile it realistically with some algorithms, so it looks realistic. So we never really store the whole building at once. We only store like piece of the building. We assemble it on the fly. Whenever you get to it, we basically build the texture for it. We also I went up the Empire State Building and took pictures from up above to get good realistic models of the. Street that we then tile, so it looks pretty realistic actually. So here's the bigger one, Times Square. I just told you about this. So there's 91 blocks, much bigger lattice size because we use a GPU cluster of 32 nodes. Nowadays we have 64 nodes with the I think 8800 GTX GPU, and then we can actually do 0.3 seconds per time step, but I think we can do much better at this point. And this is the area here, all the way up to Central Park, and then over Times Square in it, and then below, this is Times Square, 42nd Street, and so on. So this is like the area that we use, okay? And this is like the square streamlines that we have for this. So you can really see how it goes in the, just like the wind comes from here, here's the wind. And you can really see like how it goes down the streets. Broadway, I think there's Broadway somewhere. So it's coming somewhere here, it's coming. Oh, here, okay. So here the smoke is coming. And now you can really see how the smoke is attracted, because the wind comes from here, so it goes here. So okay, it was a little fast. And here's all the streets that we took. There's no people, so it's like the day after, I guess. There's no people. We were working on crowd. I mean, there's papers on crowd modeling and things like this. We could like have fleeing people, but they would like run into the smoke, so we don't want that. So here comes the smoke. These are some facades. It's really evil, evil smoke. Actually, the smoke you don't see is probably the most dangerous. Once you see it, actually, it's just carbon, usually. It's not that bad. But you can always think this is the invisible smoke, but we make it visible with computer graphics. So. Sorry, we didn't bring any smell effects to really make it realistic. So. Okay, I think that's the end. So, linear growth in number of nodes with CPU and GPUs. It's just a much faster rate with GPUs because they're so much more powerful. And it's pretty linear. Speed up factor is a little high in the smaller nodes, but then it stays pretty linear. So that's pretty good behavior. So it doesn't die. It scales very well. That's all I'm saying. Okay, so now, so this was like the volumetric effects, but now let's talk a little bit about like how do you do things on surfaces, right? How do you simulate these type of things on surfaces? So we want to like model like swirling petals and bubbles and atmosphere around the Earth and lava, water, smoking, falling, going down a mountain, or just plain fluid dripping down like some, you know, sculpture. Okay, so for this, you know, because surfaces have very intricate structures, so indeed our LBM model. Our LBM model is once more regularity. So you know you have to somehow take these mesh nodes and regularize them somehow. So the one way we can do this is we can just take local areas and flatten them locally. Okay. Yeah. And then you can use this model that we know very well about in a 2D sense in a flat area, and just link in the contributions from the other areas into the cell. I'm in time. And there is no need for global parameterization. Everything is local, and everything we understand very well locally. And all we have to like somehow, you know, adapt the theory into this new thing. And this would be very parallel because we can handle every local area independently. Okay, so what we do, we define 9 velocity vectors like we always have, and we flatten the area here, and we get this little thing here. That means these nodes here and these nodes here, as they exist in the not flattened one, it depends what you like, which ones you want to see, like how you see your problem. In any case, these regularized nodes will basically interpolate the unregular nodes here, the unregular links. So this is like basically linear interpolation, really. Just linear relation. This guy and this guy will influence this link here. Okay, and then the point is like the key challenge is how do you, because when you flatten things, obviously things are not in this nice structure that we like. You know, they're not going to be like this in this hex sort of grid that we like. So you know, you have to somehow redistribute the energy. So you have to align these things together. Okay, so here we aligned it. So basically, we just align. This guy, you know, we align this guy here with this guy here, and this guy here with this guy here, and we just project the vectors into the grid that we really like to have. So there's a little bit of attenuation in some places, a little bit more in the other places. It's not totally clean, but it's the best that you can do without the current infrastructure that you have. So there's the redistribution. So you'll see this gets done here, you know, and so on. So. And you always want to preserve the fluid density. So you scale everything in such a way that things are still what they were before. This is like the unrotated or unwarped, and this is the warped. So you just make sure that things sort of even out. So redistribute the energy a little bit. And then you can do things like this. So here you also have gravity working. So gravity adds an extra force. See, you can see this collecting here and then forming clusters and moving down. There's another one, like down the dog. You will see how it like sort of spreads out in bigger areas and the density weakens. Which is correct, because there cannot be new densities or distributions created. And it's just a local flattening. I mean, there's other groups that do this type of stuff, you know, but they do it with real fluid, with like very, like with you know, differential equations and so on. This uses like LBM, which is a discrete method, and you can do this quite fast, so you know, with relatively little effort. So you know, that's the difference, right? I mean, you've seen these SIGGRAPH papers. There's other SIGGRAPH papers that have done this type of things, but with very extreme, with very, you know, with very involved Navier-Stokes method and so on. So this is just different. But in the, as you heard before, it's quite it goes to the Navier-Stokes method. So performance on a single GPU is again an FX 4500. It's a Quadro. I think that's a is that an 8 series? The Quadro 4500. It's quite new, right? Seven. Oh, okay. I thought it's an 8 series. Okay, 7. I don't have any Quadros. I only have the G forces. Okay, it's like a 7 series. So it's like three generations ago, and then you can get like frame rates like on the Sphere, 97 frames a second, and on this Dark you saw 16, and the Taurus you go saw is 12. So it goes up with a number of phases, of course. But you know, so you can really start modeling surfaces. You can really start deforming the object as you go, right? You can really start modeling and designing the flow behavior that you'd like to see. It's interactive enough for that. So conclusion, so you can, you have a fluid solver for natural phenomena modeling. We've seen the bubbles, we've seen solid objects being exerted into flow. We've seen smoke, very, very dense structures, and then we've seen flow and surface, and we've also seen like how it's applied in real scenarios for urban security. So we've seen all this. The mirages are especially good. So we've seen all this, and okay, this is actually your part, I think. So.
First.
Huh? Sure. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, sure. Did we? Did we measure the error? I don't think we.
Yeah, for that particular application, maybe it's, we do a lot of approximation to make these kinds of graphics. But the RBM itself it have a unique conference focused on that in physics world. They have a lot of validation for that. In general speaking, they can reach the accuracy for any other.
You get more resolution, yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And the Reynolds number has also a big influence. I mean, it's just things you can't do at this point. But there was actually, I remember there was like, the best way to really, really compare it, because even if you have like a very high grade simulator, it's still a simulator, right? To actually look at the phenomena, the real object, and then try to somehow discretize that object and look at it, what the LBM does or any other method does, and really see if it matches that. But then, as it is, that's what this whole, lots of big parts of computer vision is all about, right? You measure, if you can't explain a phenomena, you try to observe it and create a modeling for that phenomena, right? Then you fake it, basically. You generate this based on something you don't quite 100% understand. That could apply here again. There are other things in that object that you have looked at, which has like slight imperfections, but you can't digitize it. You don't really know. It's hard to really say like how much error do you really have, right? It's much hard. You can only compare it to another to a high grade method. That's we should do.
Right.
Right.
If you're talking to city council, they might not care about the fine 16 decimals in the end, but if the mechanics guy was saying, what's the balance that you play, what's your experience of that, how to handle Oscar for instance?
Right. I mean, the one application that I find very compelling is for example, you want to do rapid prototyping, right? You want to get a quick feel what's going on there, right? And then maybe you spend more time but you just want to see what is, so how do I have to bend things to make it look like this? So where is my course? Where's the course of stuff go? I still make sure that no one goes in areas where I'm like, that's a whole matter of certainty. You measure uncertainty and then you try to make sure that you have a safety bound there. Right? But So it's a, you know, I see the LBM also like a good application is really this rapid prototyping where you really quickly see what it looks like. And for games, of course, people don't really care that much, right? But if you want to go into serious industrial applications, it's a perfect method for that. You can do that, right? You can just study its local effects, and then that's a good point, right? You can study the local effects with LBM, where you just modify things, but you have the boundary conditions defined by another method. Yeah, sure, you can do that too. Are there any other questions? Sure. Oh, interpolation scheme. Well, we model on that grid, so we don't interpolate. We just for the visualization we interpolate.
Right. So if you're moving particles or something, and you have a location between grid points, you simply interpolate.
Right. I think that's what we do, right?
Yeah, that's the linear. We use linear, maybe cubic interpolation.
We have some work on lattices where we try to. We published this. Yeah, I think it's just under review actually. So, where we try to come up with better ways to sample the space with better lattices, where you really make sure that there is like a good sort of isotropic behavior of this, that you don't have like holes where there is like things are not as accurate and like direct orientations where things not as accurate as others. So you can that is something you really want to make sure that you don't. Then interpolation is a little safer, right? When you don't, doesn't matter because the object is now hanging like this, you have a different result than if it's like this. So it'll be always the same within certain bounds, of course. Okay. So then you go. You can use,
yeah, thank
use
you.
This if you like.
Okay, I will continue with a few slides for the LBM can be used for not only the fluid dynamics applications. Because actually the LBM is a special numerical method solver for some kinds of partial differential equations. Okay, so we will show it can be simplified and also be modified to solve not only the Navier-Stokes equation. And these PDEs are widely used in graphene visualization for the image processing, surface processing, as well as the volumetric visualization. Okay, so we use LBM for that because it's easy to implement both for the CPU as well as GPU. And also it's flexible can be modified to accommodate more requirements from different applications, especially for the graphics hardware acceleration we have already introduced. The basic idea for this, we just started this, is that the fluid dynamics is we use the BGK model to model equilibrium. Okay, with this second order polynomial here. However, if we only want to diffusion, right, we know that inside Navier-Stokes they have the diffusion, advection, and pressures, and external forces. But if we only want to model a diffusion, that we can remove the effect of this momentum and remove the effect of the velocity u here. Therefore, we can use this equilibrium equation with this very, very simple equation here is the rho times AA is a coefficient. That is like you diffuse your rho to different links with a coefficient A that defines how many percent you should diffuse to this direction, how many you should diffuse to this direction. Then we apply the same mathematical analysis method. Finally, we can recover this equation. Actually, it's a very good diffusion equation, which is can be considered only one part inside Navier-Stokes equation. And also right now, this toys determine the diffusion coefficient. Okay, so we can use this method, which is also popularly used in physics and in graphics, to approach the result of Laplace equation here. We use this diffusion procedure. If this derivative of rho to t approaching zero, that means we almost reach this Laplace equation. Okay, in the same way, if we want to model the Poisson equation, that is not zero on the right-hand side, but this is a function h, so we can use a similar procedure, but use a function h for each point as a body force in the LBM scheme. So we get this, right? So if this is the same thing, if this derivative of rho to t approaching zero. So we can approach the result of this Poisson equation. So that is the method we want to use. And as actually, the Laplace and Poisson equation are widely used in graphics and visualization. So this is an example of image processing. We can use the density of each pixel as the computational primitive in LBM. That is, the rho is not a fluid density, but it's the intensity or grayscale level of these values inside this pixel. So this is the original image with some noise. So this is, if we use an isotropic tau here for any point, it's like isotropic smoothing. And then if you use tau for different position with a different value related to maybe some gradients or something like that, so you can achieve this anisotropic smoothing. Another example is image merging. It is a very famous paper in SIGGRAPH several years ago. It's Poisson-based image editing. We just use LBM to implement that. This is the original image. This is another one. You cut some part and want to attach here. So you need to apply some computing with on the back. It actually to solve that Poisson equation. So actually, we can use LBM to solve this. The same strategy can be applied to 3D volumetric smoothing. That is, we use LBM to smooth, to compute the voxel density values as rho. Then we can smooth this volumetric data set with noise. We get a result here. Actually, this is another example. Actually, this over smoothing is applied to the whole volumetric data set. So it's not smoothing only for one isosurface. It's smoothing the whole volumetric data set. This is the result. We use a retracing, a recasting method, and this is a matching cube. Then we generate the result surface. Okay, so if we want to go further to the 3D polygon mesh, for example, then our choice is first we can use voxelization method to generate the volume data from surface, then apply this LBM. That's sometimes inaccurate and slow, and also not easy to apply the shape interpolations. And the second choice is we can, instead of using the density of the volume as a computational primitive for LBM, we use the distance field. Actually, the distance field is a computational primitive in LBM. That is, we use that rho to represent the distance, because actually we just use the LBM as a PDE solver. Okay, so in that case, I think everybody knows that the distance field is defined by the distance from one point to this zero level set surface. Okay, so you're using the distance in the LBM, we solve this diffusion equation, and then actually with some mass here, actually it is kind of like a curvature flow, because this one actually defines a curvature. So we can use the LBM to solve, to generate the curvature flow and used for the surface smoothing. So for this case, we can apply our method directly on the distance field of any polygon mesh. So this is an example, original 3D surface, and this is, we show the curvature. And then this is the isotropic diffusion or denoising that get result. This one we use a different gamma that is actually implemented, have some relation with the tau in our LBM simulation. But right now it determines the anisotropic denoising, which based on the curvature. So we get this result. Okay, so this is another result with armadillo model. We perform the LBM computing for different time steps, we get a result like this. This is the in detail part of that smoothing. Okay, so finally, we try to introduce surface morphing, which we extend off an approach to a surface. And then we introduce, for morphing, you need a driving force, drive from one shape to another shape. So this driving force can be applied in LBM as a body force factor, which actually related to this velocity, which is actually defined by this body force. So usually, we use a simple case, just the difference between your target and this current involving morphing surface. By this way, we implement this morphing from a sphere with some noise, because our method also have the curvature effects to smooth that. So we can do the morphing and at the same time remove the noise. Okay, this is a video for that. You start from the sphere and finally generate this armadillo model. Okay, so for performance issue, this one actually has no too much overhead than these traditional classic LLVM implementations. So it's just a little bit modification, and actually it's a little bit simplified, actually, because you use an equilibrium state function instead of using that second order polynomial. We're just using one very simple computation multiplication there. Okay, so in this NVIDIA GPU, we reach a very fast speed, and actually we have the speed up than the CPU with several hundred times, especially for the denoising and smooth, because it's only applied to this surface in a very small narrow band, so it's very fast. So this is just a starting point for that to use LLVM, which is actually uses cellular automata style updating rules for solving other PDEs other than just the flow dynamics. It can achieve some fast speed with the parallel acceleration, as well as it's actually LLVM is quite easy to program, and with a few lines of codes and can finish the core algorithm. Okay, here are the references for all these application talks, and thank you very much. I'll take questions. Okay, thank you. So I'll ask Niels to present the free surface simulation.
So yeah, welcome to the last part of our tutorial. I'll now talk a bit about another fluid application, mainly free surface simulations. And this is work that has been done at the same place as Klaus is now working, mostly at the system simulation department in Erlangen. So first Klaus, right? Klaus Igelberger. And I'm now at ETH, but this is mostly work from Erlangen. So free surfaces are actually a special kind of simulation setup where you have a liquid in a gas phase, and what's interesting to you is actually the motion of the liquid itself. And this is very important because mostly we are in the air, so to say, and what we see of a liquid is the interface between the gas and the liquid. So think of pouring a glass of water, or actually if you're on a ship in the ocean or so, what you see is the interface between the liquid and the air. And the goal will be to simulate the motion of this liquid using the lattice Boltzmann method. So this is actually a fairly everyday standard phenomena, which is why it's interesting for graphics and virtual reality application, but it's also interesting for engineering applications. For example, for casting or foaming, I'll come back to that later on, where, for example, you fill a form with some liquid material, but also for example, for fuel cells or for cars, how the rain or drops move on the surface of a car. This is an important topic. So this is what I'll be talking about in the following. First, I'll explain the basic method, how to simulate these three surfaces using lattice Boltzmann. And then I'll go into some advanced topics in this direction, mainly adaptive time step, surface tension, the example of how to simulate metal foams with it, and lastly, how to do adaptive grids to speed up the whole simulation. So first, let's look at the basic model. It's based on a standard lattice Boltzmann now, so we have a regular grid of cubic cells, and typically in 2D and 3D, we can use these methods using 9 velocities or 19 in 3D. So these are the standard ones you heard about before, and I'll mostly be using the single relaxation time methods, which is basically the standard lattice Boltzmann model. So what we have to do to simulate a free surface is we first have to distinguish basically the liquid and the gas phase. So this is done by marking the cells with an additional flag, And you can see a fairly simple setup here to the right. We have a fluid region, and inside are these cells marked with F here. Those are just normal lattice Boltzmann cells, so to say, where nothing special has to be done. The gas phase, the cells marked with G here, those are the cells that we can basically ignore. This is where the gas is, which should not be simulated. And the work has to be done at the interface between the gas and the liquid. So here we have to do the computation, compute the motion of the interface. And we, for example, have to store some additional values, mainly how much of each cell is filled with the liquid. To give you an overview of the algorithm, instead of this standard stream and collide step, we have to do some additional work at the interface. And this is an overview. So the first step is actually to calculate the mass, which is the motion, the mass flux, the motion of the free surface of this interface. And after that, the streaming, so the advection, so to say, of these distribution functions can be done. And for this, the difficult part is basically to reconstruct the information that is not simulated in the gas phase. Somehow similar to the boundary conditions we've heard about before, we have to compute which distribution functions come in from this from the gas phase region. And once we have a full set of distribution functions for all cells, we can basically do the normal streaming and collide step. So I'll go in a bit into detail about these different steps. First, this motion, the mass flux. The model I'm showing here is actually similar to volume of fluid type method for normal Navier-Stokes solvers. So we actually know how much mass there is in each cell. So the nice thing is that we can really conserve the mass, and we know how much mass is moving throughout our system. And what this basically results in is that we have in the fluid region inside, there's basically a value of 1 that is completely filled. In the gas, we have 0, there's no fluid. And in between, in this interface region, there's a value in between. And to compute the motion of the interface, what we can do in the lattice Boltzmann method is to compute directly along each link in the lattice how the material of the liquid is moving. So you can imagine a distribution function as really being some small drop or volume of fluid that is moving with a fixed velocity. So to compute what is actually going out and coming into each cell, we can look at what is streamed out of a cell along each link and what's coming back in. And that is just what this equation down here says. So the change of mass along one direction is what's going out plus what's going in. So it's basically the difference between the two stream distribution functions. And that is really the flux of mass across this link in the model. And to sum, to compute how the overall mass in the cell changes, we can just sum up this value over all links we have. So for example, 19 in the 3D model. So this is the case for fluid cells and for fluid and interface cells. What we can do to make this more accurate for interface cells is to actually take into account the area between the interface cells. So for example, you might have two interface cells that are only half filled, which means that the area of fluid between these two cells is also half a cell, so to say. So what is done if you have two interface cells is that this epsilon factor, which is a fill fraction, how much fluid you have in each cell, is computed as an average between the two cells. And then this is just what was on the previous slide. The mass flux is scaled by this value to compute how much is moving along only partly filled cells. And finally, this interface layer, because it should be between fluid and the gas phase, should only be a single layer of cells, basically. So to prevent that you have cells, interface cells, that are, for example, only surrounded by fluid cells, or you have interface cells which are basically stuck in the gas phase somewhere, you can introduce some additional rules to, for example, force interface cells within the fluid to fill or within the gas phase to empty. And that is done by looking at the neighborhood of these cells, and depending on whether there are no fluid neighbors or no empty neighbors, you can actually, instead of having this standard formula here along the diagonal, you can force these cells to really only fill or empty. And this ensures that you only have a single layer of interface cells around your fluid. So this is all that's necessary to compute the motion of the free surface. And now in the next step, what is necessary to do the streaming step of the lattice Boltzmann is to compute what is basically coming from the gas phase. And with the lattice Boltzmann, that can be done by looking at the or by taking the equilibrium distribution functions, what the free surface basically should do is we assume the gas has a very low density compared to the liquid, so it basically should not be, the liquid should not be slowed down by the gas phase. And to compute what actually comes into a cell, we can sum up two equilibrium distribution functions from a current cell and subtract the one that is known from the liquid phase, from the fluid actually, and this gives the value that is coming in from the gas phase. So this is also a fairly simple formula. This gives you the boundary conditions along the free surface. So note that one simplification here is that, for example, you have no shear forces along the interface. So if you have, for example, a wind moving tangential to your fluid surface, this will not cause any forces. You would need additional terms for that. And with these two steps, you can basically run the normal lattice-Boltzmann loop once over your grid, do the streaming and collision. And now another thing that has to be taken care of is the actual movement. At some point, you will get cells that actually empty and cells that fill, and then you will have to change the state of these cells, so the interface layer has to move with the free surface. And a problem here is typically that because we have a discrete time step, these cells will not completely empty or fill. So there will be some excess mass left in these cells, which can be actually negative or also slightly more than actually 100%. And what needs to be done is to redistribute this mass according to the motion along the new neighbors. So for example, if you have some interface cell that fills, what needs to be done is the cell should not, if it's full, it should be a fluid cell, but the gas cells around it should now be treated as interface cells to extend this layer of interface cells around the fluid, and you can actually move this excess mass along into these new interface cells. So this is basically a third step that comes after the loop over your grid. And to give you a bit of a comparison, this is similar to these volume of fluid methods, so it's really mass conserving, which is a nice thing. You don't, if you do it right, you do not lose any mass. You can ensure that the mass stays constant up to machine precision. One alternative method that's often used are those level sets, where you basically store the distance to your interface within a grid. These are used in graphics a lot, for example. So the advantage is that you have more information also away from the interface. So for example, you can compute a more accurate curvature, but typically these require quite expensive reinitializations, and also there's no notion of mass, so these are typically not mass conserving. And so for our experiments, the lattice-Boltzmann volume of fluid method worked quite well. And shortly about the how to render or visualize these effects. Here we can nicely use ray tracing methods because we have basically an interface from these mass values. For example, with the Martian cubes, we can construct a triangulation of the surface and then ray trace this. And there are some important effects to take care of, mainly the refraction and reflection according to how you view the surface. So that's a Fresnel term. And what it does basically is that if you look straight onto a surface, you can look through the surface, but once the angle becomes smaller, the rays get more and more reflected. So you can see this on the inside of this cube. Here on the inside, the bubbles are actually reflected because the angle becomes smaller, while if you look straight onto it, you can just see through. So that is an important term. And another one are the caustics. You can see on the bottom here, where also due to the reflection and refractions, the light is focused onto patches on the floor. And this can also be computed with ray tracing by using basically a reverse pass. Typically for ray tracing, you just trace rays from the camera into the scene to check how the light is coming into the scene. And these caustics you can compute with a photon mapping approach, where you basically do a pass from the light source into the scene to check where these light patches are appearing. And to show you a fairly simple example of this, this is a small simulation done with this basic free surface model. And this was a fairly early one, but to basically validate it a bit, this is a real test case in a small aquarium. You can see there's a reflection of my neighbor here that is missing in the other one. And this is a simulation, also a fairly small one, around 100 cubed with the same setup. You can see the overall motion, even with this basic model, is fairly okay. Oh, Yeah, in this case, we just assume it's in one moment removed. So there's, yeah, in reality, there's of course... Right, so in this case, it's just removed immediately, no time, and here you have some effect of the surface being pulled up, but yeah, I hope it's small enough, so it's a plastic plate. Yeah. Right here, there's really no wall that's being pulled away. We just put the fruit there and assume it's gone when the simulation starts. So I'll come back to more realistic test cases later on. Yeah. So this is a basic model, and one thing to note is that within Lattice Boltzmann, there's not really a parameter for the time step. It's basically an explicit update, so it's also slightly compressible depending on the time step you take. It's not a fully incompressible flow you're simulating, but in the limit of a small time step, what you get is the behavior of an incompressible flow. But yeah, you can't really choose the size of a time step. And this is actually somewhat unfortunate for these free surface simulations, because the velocities might vary a lot. So for example, if you have a drop that's falling down, it typically accelerates, it hits some obstacles, but you have highly varying velocities, and similar to a CFL condition, also the time step has to be small enough to basically capture all the velocities in your model. So if you have to compute with a fixed time step, you have to choose a very small one for the highest velocities that occur throughout the whole simulation. And this basically costs an unnecessary amount of computations. So what you can do to alleviate this is to basically change the state of your system within the Lattice Boltzmann and continue computations using a new time step. And you can do this in intervals, to basically when the velocities get too large, you change the time step to a larger value and compute with this one, or if they become too small, at fixed intervals you reduce or you enlarge the time step. And this is done similar to what's done for coupling grids of different resolutions. What you basically need to, or the change of the time step results in a changed viscosity. This tau, this relaxation time, depends on the spatial resolution and also on the size of the time step. It's so to say a viscosity that depends on the parameters of your simulation. If you change the time step, this relaxation time changes. And what that means is that you also have to change the non-equilibrium parts in your simulation, because those basically contain the information about how far your system is off from a steady state. And so what you can do to change the time step is compute the non-equilibrium part. This is really this here. You just subtract the equilibrium from your current distribution function. Then this is scaled by a factor that is dependent on the new and the old viscosity. So this one, the tau n, is a new one, and this is the old one. And in the end, you multiply this to, for example, account for a different velocity. And once you do this over the whole grid, this is similar to a collision step, so to say, in the normal model. You have changed the state of your simulation in a way that you can continue with a new time step. One thing to note here, as mentioned before, the viscosity can be a problem. So if you want to have very fluids with a very low viscosity, for example, water, the stability of the Lattice Boltzmann method is somewhat limited. So what I'm using here in the following is a Smagorinsky turbulence model, which is a fairly simple one, but it works quite nicely for Lattice Boltzmann to stabilize the simulation, because it basically chooses the right viscosity for each cell locally to keep it stable. And this way you can basically tell the simulation to go as low with the viscosity as possible. If you're interested in this, there's actually from another tutorial at SIGGRAPH this year, there's a very small, so to say, learning code, example code of this turbulence model with the standard Lattice Boltzmann, if you want to take a look at this. And using these adaptive time steps together with the turbulence model, you can get simulations like this. So this is now a falling drop. It splashes around, so you get a fairly low viscosity in the simulation and some interesting behavior. And you can basically choose the time step according to the different velocities you have in the simulation. So if we take a look at how the velocities change, naturally in the beginning there are basically all velocities are zero, then the drop accelerates, the time step goes down more and more, that is basically, you can see this in this graph down here. It goes down until it hits the water surface, then you have fairly high velocities for a while. And the highest velocities you actually get when the fluid splashes back together in the middle and shoots upwards. So here you have another decrease in the time step, that is it, this area here. And afterwards the fluid basically slows down again and the time step gets larger and larger. So this accelerates the overall simulation time quite a bit if you can do this adaptive time stepping. Another important topic for, especially for engineering applications, or if you look at smaller scale things, is surface tension. So far there are no forces in these boundary conditions. But for surface tension, you basically need to compute the curvature of your interface and then add a force depending on whether it's curved outwards or inwards. And this can be done within these boundary conditions, given that you have computed the curvature, by scaling sum of these two equilibrium functions by the sigma term here, which accounts for a surface tension force. And then you just subtract the known distribution function again. So this is basically how you can add forces at the fluid interface within this model. And a fairly simple way to compute the curvature might be to use this marching cube surface and then compute basically two principal curvature directions, for example, along the two largest one along the axis aligned planes, and compute an average of these two. This is not too accurate, but gives a first approximation of the curvature. What you can actually do if you want to have it a bit more accurate is to, for example, take into account the change of the triangles along the normal of the surface, or also for stability of the curvature, compute this over larger areas of the surface to get a more stable approximation. What you also tried, but which is very expensive, is to really compute a full signed distance function from the surface you have, and then compute the curvature on this one. But most of the simulations I'll show in the following are actually using this area-based curvature computations. So this is especially important for the metal foam test case, which was actually one of the motivations for starting this work in Erlangen. So I want to talk about this a bit. Here you have foams in a variety of materials, actually, although it sounds a bit exotic. But for example, you can make foams of glass, ceramics, polymers. And metal foams are basically a special case that's very interesting for a variety of applications, because on one hand, it's very stable. It's a metal after all, but it's light because you have all the bubbles inside. It's very stiff against rotations, and it has some good properties in terms of energy absorption and damping. So it might, for example, be interesting for bumpers in car, which should absorb a shock, or also for batteries that need a high surface. So the idea was here to really understand, control, and optimize this process. This was done in cooperation with the Material Science Institute in Erlangen, who are manufacturing these metal foams, and who also provided these images here. So these are really scans of real metal foams they produced. And what's important here now is to have a very even distribution of all the bubbles in the foam, because as you can imagine, if you have a block of material produced with this that has one large bubble, the stability will basically depend on this large bubble and on the thin surface parts around it. So what you want to have is to get a very even distribution of bubbles to get a uniform material out of this. And it strongly depends on all the parameters of the process. So for example, on the materials you're using to foam up your liquid metal, but also on the parameters you choose, like the heat, for example, you put into the oven, and basically how quickly the bubbles grow and then coalesce, so fall back down into each other again. And the idea was to simulate this to better control the overall process. And because it's a foam, it's actually quite important to treat these large areas of your surface as well, which is why for this case, for example, it's nice to have the thin interface layer, because there's lots of interface in the foam overall. And what you can additionally do to the surface tension force is you can compute the masses and the volumes of the bubbles and then add an additional pressure term to track the bubbles and simulate them within the lattice Boltzmann method. What makes it a bit hard is that you have quite different time scales. So one hand is the growing of the foam, the foaming up, and when bubbles burst and grow coalesce, this is actually much faster than the overall growing process. So you have different time scales, and the surface tension is actually quite important to stabilize the foam in the end. So I'd like to show some results that were done by the material scientists with the Sledge-Boltzmann code. So here's an earlier one with lots of bubbles in the beginning, and as you can see, it actually foams up the domain in the end, but lots of bubbles get lost, lots of bubbles coalesce and break up. Or another case is this one, where it's the material is initially not touching the walls, but it's really expanding throughout the volume. And also in this case, it's not really a stable foam because all the bubbles break apart in the end. So one more realistic example was this one. So these examples, by the way, were also validated using their measured foams. And this gives a stable configuration of a foam now. And they actually found out that there are some stabilizing forces in the process of cooling down of this liquid metal that stabilize the bubbles more than the surface tension itself does, so that this foam can really turn out the way it does in the end. So finally, I want to talk a bit about how to speed up performing large-scale simulations of these liquids. So here, the goal is basically to focus the accuracy of the computations on the free surface. After all, that is what you see from the simulation. And for example, if you have a large volume, it might be very nice if you can reduce the amount of computations there by really reducing the spatial discretization inside of the fluid volume. So this will be the goal in the following. And what this approach here is based on is a paper by Philip Holver and Tehnel from 98, which proposed a basic coupling of different grid scales. To keep it a bit simpler, we only change the resolution by factors of two. So if you have one cell, you basically, to get to the next coarser level, what you can do in 3D is to get together eight cells to form one larger cell that has twice the spatial resolution. And as you can imagine, in this case, the links between the different Lattice-Boltzmann cells will not match up totally anymore, so there's some form of interpolation needed. In the following, we will just do linear interpolation, which for us gave good results, but you can also use higher order interpolations. And basically, the main challenge is to adapt this coarsening, the change of your discretization to the movement of the free surface. So down here is an example where a drop falls down, and the grids basically have to adapt to the motion of this free surface in a way that does not kill the performance gain you get by computing more coarse simulation. So one nice thing actually about using the Lattice-Boltzmann method here is that the time step changes together with the spatial resolution. So imagine we have three different grids of larger and larger resolutions, original fine one here, and then one twice as large, one four times as large. If we have a steady or a known state in the beginning and we do one Lattice-Boltzmann step on each, we actually advance the grids by different time steps. So by one delta T for this one, twice as much for this grid, and for the largest one, we have actually four times the size of a single time step. So now to perform another time step on the fine grid, what we have to do is actually temporally interpolate the information from the coarser grid to get a boundary condition for the fine grid, and then we can do another time step or another computation step on the fine grid. And by temporary interpolating from the finest from the coarsest one, again we can do another step on the middle grid, and this way proceed by advancing the whole simulation. The nice thing again is that we really have to do less work because on the coarser grids, because it's a larger spatial resolution, and also the time step is larger. So this again saves some work. Here's a typical setup you might find in a simulation. The finest grid has a free surface here, and away from it, we compute with the finest resolution. At some point, there's a boundary condition, these yellow cells, where the information is transferred from the coarser level to the very fine one. So this is the next coarse one, and here you again have two types of boundary conditions, one that gets it from a coarser level and another one that gets it from a finer level. And on the coarsest one, in this case, you only have the ones that gets it from a finer. But this way you have basically overlapping grids that grow coarser and coarser away from the interface. And again, the changed time step in this case means that we have a changed viscosity on the different grids, and that we have to scale the non-equilibrium parts of the distribution function similar to the changed time steps by a factor that depends on the two viscosities on the grids. And so far, this was mostly static, but these different layers also have to adapt to the motion of the free surface. So for this, we use a set of five different rules that really look only at the cell types on each grid, and then adapt these boundary layers that transfer the information between the grids to this motion of the free surface. And here you can see one example of these rules. So for example, if you have a cell in the upper row here that gets information from fine grid and is moved, the yellow layer of transfer cells have to be moved accordingly. So you can find the details of this in the paper. I'd like to show some results of this. So these are now fairly large-scale simulations of 480 cubed cells, and all of them were done, in this case, with two coarser grid levels. And especially in this case, this works quite well. Here you have a large volume of fluid in the bottom and a drop falling into it. And especially for this larger volume, you get a nice speed up while still being able to produce very fine drops at the fluid surface. A more tougher test case basically for this adaptive approach is this one, where you have a breaking dam similar to the side-by-side example before that splashes through the domain. So initially you have a fairly large volume, but it spreads out a lot and splashes around towards the end of the simulation. So this test case is tougher for adapting your grids to the motion of the free surface. Also you have very large velocities in this case. And the final example is more to demonstrate a bit more of a complex geometry and a more realistic setting. So here, a glass of water is basically filled with some liquid, and yeah, it's too fast, so liquid spills. But you get some interesting effects at the fluid surface here. And yeah, this was rendered in Blender, and you can, for example, what you could not easily do in real time in reality, but you can do a camera movement while pouring in this water, focusing on the droplets. So what you don't really see here are the different grids, but you can, for example, measure the speed up you gain by introducing coarser and coarser levels. So the first bars in both cases that you see here are just the normal simulations computed completely on the fine level. And when introducing additional coarse levels, this is how the overall computation time changes. So the first, the left-hand side here is this falling drop example, the other one the breaking dam. As you can see, the first introducing one coarse level in both cases basically reduces the time to 1/3. And for the falling drop, because of the large volumes, introducing a second one, you basically get to roughly 1/4 of the initial simulation time. While for the breaking dam example, again, the first level worked quite efficiently, but doing a second and third one don't give that much of an effect. At least it doesn't really get slower. There's additional overhead after all, because these grids have to be checked. But you can basically just leave them on and see how much the algorithm gets out of the additional levels. To also shortly look at the distribution between the grids, it's still the case that almost three-quarters of the overall computations are done on the fine grid. So there's some overhead, 14%, for changing the grids, but the actual fluid simulations on the coarse levels are only 7% in our implementation, so this is basically very little work, and there's some overhead still. So this brings me to the end of my talk. I have shown a mass-conserving volume of fluid scheme for lattice Boltzmann that works integrates nicely and works quite efficiently. It can be combined with, for example, surface tension effects or bubble simulations. And to increase the efficiency of the simulations, you can, for example, add adaptive time steps or adaptive grids to speed up the simulations. And there's a variety of open problems that might be looked at that are interesting. So the this was all done using the single relaxation time model with the turbulence model. But as mentioned before, this multi-relaxation time methods are interesting, or also there are newer cascaded lattice Boltzmann schemes. So combining these with these two surface simulations might be interesting. Also, because of the performance of GPUs, I think you could achieve quite nice real-time free surface simulations on using, for example, CUDA. Interfacing with moving obstacles for free surfaces is an interesting topic, and also especially for in the graphics field, to control these animations is important. So here I'd shortly like to show a last example where we tried that. Let me move forward. So this is actually what you need for movies a bit more, that the fluid not only does realistic, not only shows the realistic behavior, but that basically an animator or director can change the fluid in a way that looks, gets the right look for a film. And here you have some figure forming out of the fluid, which of course is not very realistic, but might be necessary for a movie. And intuitively controlling and working with these fluid simulations for movies is still an open problem. So here are some examples of papers where you can find more information. You can find these on the web. So thanks to a variety of people, among others Professor Rüder and Caroline Körner, who worked on the metal foam project, and many others. And if you're interested in trying the free surface simulations, they're actually part of the Blender open source program, so you can just download it. There's also an implementation that is, however, not really meant to learn it. It's quite optimized, and the papers you can find on this link here. So thanks for your attention. That's it for my part. Any questions?
First, the web page that in token/fluid doesn't work right now.
Okay, that's bad. I'll check.
I clicked it.
It should work.
You said there's an implementation in Blender.
Right.
Can you actually save out the volume fractions that you're calculating for the mesh cells, or just the surfaces?
What it does by default is only save the triangulation of the surface, but you could fairly easily modify it to save volume fractions or velocities. So mail me, I can send you some code to put into.
I'd like that.
Yeah. Shouldn't be.
Also, so you're using marching cubes to extract
for the
final surfaces.
Yeah.
So how do you get volume conservation with marching cubes?
Right, it's not volume conserving.
And with your bubbles, can you get two bubbles that come within, say, one grid cell of each other?
Yeah, one cell is still okay.
So you can't have two intersections along an edge with marking cubes.
Right, no. It's also in the model. You have to capture basically the dynamics of both surfaces. I think one cell is even not enough. You should have two interface cells on each side of the fluid. So in practice, they can be as close as almost one cell. But if it's really one cell or below, these bubbles have to merge for the simulation as well.
They flip to the other side, basically.
Yeah, if you only have one cell, I think you don't have enough information in the simulation to compute the dynamics of both surfaces.
Okay.
So in this case, what's done here is to basically merge the two bubbles and connect them so they get together due to surface tension. Good. Okay, so.
Okay. Thank you. And do you have many more general questions that we can answer for this issue? Okay, thank you. We will make all the slides available online, and I have shown the web page. Actually, it's under my homepage, so you can easily find that. Okay, thank you very much. Yeah, most of them are already available. For example, Nier's movie is available there. So, yeah. Thank you.